This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are about to witness an evolution. On each episode, we will take a deep dive into the career of a legendary wrestling superstar, looking at all of the elements that led to and contributed to their long-term success. With your host, Andy Atherton.
Place to Be Nation Wrestling, welcome to the third episode of The Evolution here on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. I'm your host, Andy Atherton, and tonight we're taking a deep dive. First time, well, we talked a little WCW on our first two episodes, but this guy is WCW. And I brought in the guy that is the biggest fan of anybody I know of this wrestler. He is the godfather, Nate Milton. Nate, how are you tonight?
What's going on, Brother Andy? Yes, you know, I heard the first couple episodes, and I was on the outside looking in, and I felt just like Aaron Burr. I needed to be in the room where it happened, Andy Atherton. And so I said, you know what, let me call Andy Atherton and let him know that I want to talk about a specific person, and I don't care if anybody else requests this wrestler, because I'm not going to throw away my shot, Andy.
No, you didn't.
That's all the Hamilton I got for now.
All right. So, for those of you, I mean, this guy needs no introduction, but let me just give him one briefly. He is the co-host here on the wrestling feed on The Main Event with Scott Priscolo and Steve Willey. You can hear him on Chain Reaction on reviewing pay-per-views, as well as the Kings of Sport over there on the... It's a whole feed itself, Kings of Sport, right? Is that correct?
Yep.
All right. And you got the Nubian Wrestling Advocates, you got the Rocky Maivia Picture Show, Twinny Twin Twin, and the Black Lightning Podcast. All great shows. I suggest you check it out. But tonight, Nate is a guest here on Evolution. And Nate, let's kind of get things going a little bit. Who are we talking about tonight, Nate?
Well, the one thing that's for sure about this podcast, Andy, is nothing's for sure. Because we are talking about the icon, the franchise, that man called Sting.
Woo! A little Sting thing in the background. Yes, I am really glad that you picked this because Sting is my favorite WCW guy of all time. I loved him from when I first started watching WCW. I watched WCW almost as religiously as I watched WWE growing up, and I love Sting. I was never into the heels when I was younger, and Sting was kind of like the, I considered him like the Ricky Steamboat. Like Ricky Steamboat was WWF, Sting was WCW. He was the guy for the kids, for the Flash, the, you know, the superhero-esque kind of thing. And I'm really can't wait to deep dive and get educated on the man called Sting. But first, let's kind of just paint the picture and begin at the beginning. Steve Borden, a.k.a. Sting, he was born in Omaha, Nebraska, but he was raised in Southern California, played football and basketball in high school, and later embarked in a career in bodybuilding. He once co-owned a Gold's Gym health club. Ironically, had no interest in professional wrestling and had no television access to it within his home community, but he decided to pursue a career in the industry after being taken to an incredible World Wrestling Federation event in Los Angeles, where he saw Hulk Hogan, the Iron Sheik, British Bulldog, Andre the Giant, and others perform. So he first started wrestling under the name Flash. Now he teamed with Jim Justice Hellwig. You know, everybody knows Jim Hellwig. He later became the Ultimate Warrior in the WWF. As two members of Power Team USA in the independent All-California Championship Wrestling. It was a four-man unit, also featuring Garland Glory Donahoe and Mark Commando Miller, plus manager Rick Bassman, or Bassman, however you pronounce it, Helwig and Borden then later moved to Continental Wrestling Association, a company based out of Memphis, Tennessee, and they became known as the Freedom Fighters. Fans were slow to respond to the lumbering Hulk, so they turned the team heel. Then the Freedom Fighters left the CWA after an uneventful run, and the highlight of which was an angle which they broke the leg of veteran wrestler Phil Hickerson. So, do you know much about Sting's early life, basically growing up and into his first stint in wrestling?
Yeah, I know, like, the backstory, the history of that man, Steve Borden, and you know, obviously I've watched documentaries, both produced in TNA and also in the WWE, about his upbringing and the way that he found his route to professional wrestling through Hulk Hogan, basically, but, you know, both through seeing that WWF event and also, you know, with wrestlers that were stopping through town coming to his gym. And so, like, that might be one of the few good things Hulk Hogan has contributed to this world, and I'm just going to leave it at that, Andy.
I hear what you're saying.
People know how I feel about Terry Bollea, and I'm sure the feeling is mutual. But I think when you talk about, you know, the CWA and the UWF, I've heard those stories, and I know about Rick Bassman and the Power Team USA and the fact that basically it was kind of like a male version of the Diva Search, if you will, in that he just looked for the most physically appealing, jacked, swole dudes he could find, not caring if they could wrestle or not. And so Sting was there, Warrior was there, he had these two other big muscle dudes, and Sting and the Warrior were the two best out of the bunch. And so, like, Sting's often talked about being on the road with Warrior and going through CWA and then to the UWF with Bill Watts and just kind of that grind early on in his career. And so, yeah, like, I've seen a match or two, but, like, this is the part of Sting's history that I think most fans are the least familiar with, because it was before Sting popped. It was before Sting hit it big. So, yeah, like, I know the stories and I've heard some of the names, but, like, this is the area in my Sting memory that, like, is the least strong.
Well, I mean, and there's no blame in there. No, because this is... you know, it's not like now where everything is documented, everything's streaming, everything's available. They'll probably, you know, you'll be hard pressed. You have to go deep dive on the internet to find tapes of some of these early matches, probably if they even exist. But I mean, I only knew about Sting's pre WCW career. Like, oh, he was a tag team partner with the Warrior and they were the Blade Runners. Yeah. That's really all I heard, that one line. But continue on, like you mentioned, his run in the UWF, that's where they surfaced as a tag team. It was run by Bill Watts and based in Louisiana, and their name was changed to the Blade Runners. He changed his ring name from Flash to Sting. Helwig became known as Rock. Then they soon joined Hot Stuff and Hyatt International, a heel stable headed by Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert and Missy Hyatt, together with Russian wrestler Kuritsa Koroshenko. The Blade Runners became the henchmen in Gilbert's on-screen feud with Watts. Jim Helwig left the promotion in mid-96, leaving Sting without a partner. He won the UWF Tag Team Championship twice with Gilbert in 86 and the third time with Rick Steiner in 1987. And then following a match against Terry Taylor in mid-87, Gilbert interfered on Taylor's behalf, costing Sting the match. Then Taylor and Gilbert ganged up on Sting until Gentleman Chris Adams came to Sting's aid. They cleared the ring and asked if Sting was with him or against him. Sting turned face by declaring his allegiance to Adams. Behind the scenes, though, Gilbert had endorsed Sting by telling the Dirt Sheet that Sting would be a megastar in the future. Later that year, he was tapped to win the UWF Television Championship, then held by Eddie Gilbert until Jim Crockett and the NWA bought the company from Watts. Crockett's booker, Dusty Rhodes, decided to put the television title on Taylor to set up a feud between Taylor and NWA Television Champion Nikita Koloff to unify the two titles. He then used unknown Shane Douglas as a transitional champion from Gilbert Taylor because Rhodes did not want to diminish Sting's growing stardom with a brief title run. So this continues on, and Sting starts to... it sounds like Sting went through a transition where he went from being part of a tag team and part of a faction, now kind of being his own man. Is that what you think happened here with Steve Borden?
Yeah, because I think Watts and Rhodes, it sounds like they, you could tell, even though Sting was raw, Like, there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
And we can start to mold this kid and get him to the point where one day he can be a draw, one day he can make us some money. And so, yeah, I think, you know, working with somebody like a Rick Steiner, and particularly working with somebody like Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, who doesn't get a whole hell of a lot of credit, mm-hmm. but anybody you talk to or listen to from that time period will tell you, Eddie Gilbert was one of the smartest people in the business, one of the most creative people in the business. So I'm sure just kind of being in that locker room and soaking up all that knowledge probably was a benefit to him in those early days.
Yeah, it sounds like, if you know, kind of going through this already, in his early career, you know, you're like, these are a who's who of, you know, 80s wrestling in terms of guys who ran behind the scenes. You know, you got Bill Watts, you got Eddie Gilbert, you got Dusty. I mean, all these guys were responsible for, you know, forming the Southern wrestling that, you know, Sting is synonymous with. You know, Southern wrestling, basically, because WCW is based out of the South, and he was never a WWE guy, which was, quote-unquote, Northern wrestling. But he moves on to Jim Crockett Productions.
Yeah, I want to say also in those mm-hmm. early years, mm-hmm. that's also when he formed a relationship with Jerry Jarrett,
okay.
who is Jeff Jarrett's father, and that'll play into Sting's third act, I guess, once we get to the TNA years.
Yeah, yes. Not his final act, but, you know, the penultimate act in his career. But so, like we were saying, he moved on to Jim Crockett Productions because they had bought, you know, the Federation, and he arrived in the NWA in July of 87. Dusty Rhodes used an opening bout of Crockett's first 480 pay-per-view, Starrcade 87, for a showcase for Sting, which he partnered with P.S. Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin, a.k.a. the Freebirds, in a six-man tag match against Gilbert, Steiner, and Larry Zbyszko that had ended in a 15-minute time limit draw. He established himself as a rising star. He was one of the few UWF alumni to be pushed in the NWA. At Clash of Champions in March of 1988, Sting challenged Flair for the NWA World Championship. The match ended in a draw after a 45-minute time limit expired, and the ringside judges could not declare a winner. Wow, you don't see that. You don't see time limits like 45 minutes. And this is a very Crockett WCW, which with judges. That was one thing that I remember set apart from primarily watching WWF up until this time.
Well, this is the match, this clash match. Like, this is, if I'm looking at the definitive matches of Sting's early NWA / WCW run, like, this is right up there. Because mm-hmm. This is the match where Flair basically put Sting on the map. And again, like, we're seeing an early pattern, Andy, of veterans giving Sting, I don't know if it's them giving Sting or if Sting earning it, probably a combination somewhere in the middle, mm-hmm. Of them seeing the work that this guy is putting in. And so you've got Dusty giving him the opening spot on the first pay-per-view. And then you've got Flair, who is looking at this basically unknown, and he's like, yeah, I'll go 45 minutes with this kid. And so you're seeing a pattern of Sting working hard, but also the veterans respecting him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, they don't give these shots to anybody.
No.
Just, you know, this kid is earning them. He's got a character. He's got a persona. He could go in the ring.
The PN News isn't getting these spots.
No. You know,
Ranger Ross is not going 45 minutes with Ric Flair.
I mean, you know, Flair is awesome, but he can't carry PN News for 45 minutes. You know, I don't think I could carry PN News for 4 minutes. But, you know, yeah, it was incredible. Because this guy kind of, he was there, and he just started steadily. Like, it wasn't that it was like a rocket ship, but it was a steady move up. There was no stutter, nothing. This guy just went in a straight line up to the top. He ended up battling members of the Four Horsemen stable. He teamed with Nikita Koloff at the Great American Bash in July of 88 to challenge the Horsemen, Tully, and Arn for the tag championships, which, you know, it seemed a pattern of draws.
Yeah. I think it'd be really interesting, Andy, to, like, to take a look at where Warrior was at this time, because they've, mm-hmm. like, they started at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sting goes to Crockett, and Warrior goes to World Class.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, you know, now knowing what we know about kind of that world-class atmosphere, where you've got all these great wrestlers, but maybe the rules are a little bit lax, shall we say, about kind of personal conduct. Like, I wonder if Sting goes to world-class, does he end up being, you know, somebody who is respected as much as he is today?
Probably not. You know, Warrior, you know, I mean, you compare the two guys, right? Warrior was your sprinter. You know, you think the Warrior could have done these time limit draws, you know, the 20 minute, the 15, even, you know, let's not even talk about the 45 minute draw, but the 20 minute, the 15 minute.
Yeah.
I mean, no. Warrior was your guy. Sting's your you know, if you're a high school track coach, you're looking at these two guys, you're getting Sting for your cross country team, and you're taking Warrior for your 100 yard dash, basically.
Yeah, like even if you look at world class, like Warrior was the basically almost like a special attraction guy. Mm-hmm. Like he's the mystery tag team partner for Kerry Von Erich to beat the Freebirds, or you know, he's the guy that's going to come in and fight P.Y. Too High. I'm just throwing names out. And he's going to come in and squash this dude, you know, in 3 or 4 minutes. But he's not the guy. Like, he's got a featured spot in world class, but he's certainly not where Sting is in Crockett, where you can tell that they've got plans, long-term plans for this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, Warrior's the kind of guy where you – and Vince did this so well – is you catch lightning in a bottle. You know, you get this guy. You understand what this guy's shelf life is. Because nobody can go at that pace for and sustain it for a long time. You know, you get what you can out of him, make the money off of him. You know, unfortunately, you know, I mean, I guess we had a happy ending in the long run, but not so happy in a way at the time. You know, he got what he got out of the Warrior.
Yeah.
And made the money, and Warrior had the fame and all that stuff. But it pales in comparison to Sting's career. You know, Sting was your guy that you could put him in this role, in that role. He can hang with anybody in the ring.
Yeah, like you can make the argument that Warrior maybe had the higher peak, but in terms of the full career, like it's not even close.
Yeah, yeah. Warrior's like your guy, you want to put like, you know, he's your running back that's like the top, he's your Priest Holmes for a couple of years, but, you know, Sting's like your Brett Favre. He's your guy that's, you know, going to be in the league for years and going to be steady, win a couple championships. You know, Warrior is the best guy in the league for like 2 years and then he flings out kind of thing. Loads of analogies tonight already off the bat. So continue on with Dusty Rhodes booking Sting, right? And he put him in title matches with the U.S. NWA United States champ, Barry Windham, the NWA television champ, Mike Rotunda. In the fall of 88, though, he was attacked by Hawk and Animal, the Road Warriors, after a televised match. As the, you know, Rhodes the booker, he wanted Sting to be the face. He knew Sting was the most over, and that he had a plan to turn the Road Warriors. And who do you have them attack? You have your most over guy. Because nobody wanted to see the Road Warriors as heels. And he teamed with Sting to challenge the Road Warriors for the championship of Starrcade 88. And they got the win by DQ, which allowed the Road Warriors to retain the titles. Do you remember that whole situation with the Road Warriors and Sting?
Yeah, like that was really interesting because, again, like you can see Dusty. Like, God bless Dusty. God rest his soul. Like, We all love the Dream, like one of the greatest. But you could tell, like, Dusty is not being truly magnanimous here with the booking, because like there was another tag team partner in that match that you mentioned, Andy Atherton.
Yes.
And that was the American Dream, baby. So Dusty's like, I'm gonna make sure that I'm gonna lift Sting up, but in doing so, I'm gonna make sure I'm right there with him.
Yeah. Yeah, kinda.
We can all go to the pay window, if you will.
There's plenty of room there, brother, for us. Both of us at the pay window. Yeah, so I don't remember this part because this is kind of just a hair before I started really watching WCW. I remember seeing the Road Warriors a little bit. I saw them in magazines. I had a book that I had gotten as a kid that had them in it. And they were like these just larger-than-life monsters kind of thing.
I know like a lot of people, particularly I think like the Place to Be Nation audience probably skews a bit more towards fans that grew up watching WWE as opposed to, you know, somebody like me who grew up in the South and grew up on Crockett and grew up on the NWA and WCW. But like as good as the Road Warriors were or the Legion of Doom were in the WWF, like they were so great in Crockett and in the NWA because they were like two ultimate warriors. But they could actually go out there and have these amazing, hard-hitting 15, 20-minute matches. Mm-hmm. And you know, you put them in there with the Horsemen. You put them in there with Dusty. You know, you put them in there with Sting or Luger. And you just let these guys go out there. And they were this – they had this aura about them. And so, yeah, it was really hard to get people to boo the Road Warriors. And so I think that's, like, a testament to just how popular Sting was at the time that you could actually get people to boo Hawk and Animal.
Yes. Yeah, I'm was full aware, actually. Even though I wasn't that familiar with them, I knew we didn't have them at their peak in WWF. I mean, I was at SummerSlam 91. When they beat the Nasties for the belts. That was the one match I was looking forward to the most because I was a huge, you know, Road Warriors mark. I still don't want to call them the Legion of Doom because they're the Road Warriors to me, even though I'm more, you know, familiar with the WWF stuff. But so he returned to Singles matches in 89, starting the year off by wrestling Flair again to a 1-hour draw in the Omni in Atlanta on New Year's Day. He also goes over to Japan, has a brief tour with all Japan Pro Wrestling, and has a notable match against Dan Spivey in June of 89. After a long push, Sting wins his first title in NWA when he defeats Rotundo for the NWA Television Championship at a live event in March. Sting then defends... Sting then defends the television title actively, but tended to face subpar challengers such as Iron Sheik. And then in mid-89, the Great Muta challenged Sting at the Great American Bash. The match was booked with a classic controversial Dusty finish, even though Rhodes had been fired months earlier. Sting got a 3-count and was announced the winner, but a replay showed Muta's shoulder was up. It was at the count of 2. The NWA decided to declare the title vacant. Sting and Muta battled in many rematches for the vacant television title, but they always ended in DQ, giving neither man a championship. Eventually, Muta won a no-DQ match against Sting in a live event by using a blackjack to get the win. In the main event of that year's Great American Bash, Flair defended the NWA World Heavyweight Championship against Terry Funk, who was a member of Gary Hart's J-Tex Corporation.
Yes.
Yes, I remember that. Now we're about to where I started watching.
Okay, yeah, and then this, like, taking a step back to Sting and Muta, like, I know a lot of people will say that, like, Flair was Sting's first great feud, and you can make an obvious argument for that, you know, going back to Clash 1. But I think Sting and Flair don't really heat up until the 90s. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, I think Sting, to me, just as a Sting fan, like, that Sting-Muta feud, when they were both at the peak of their athletic primes, before Sting got older and Muta's knees gave out on him. Like, I thought that was some of the best wrestling I'd ever seen to that point. Because we all know what Muta was at that point, but Sting was matching him, you know, move for move, hold for hold. And then just seeing these two athletic guys, because Muta's, like, people think of Muta at that time as more like a cruiserweight, but Muta wasn't a small dude.
No.
And so you got these guys who are, you know, probably pushing 250, 260, maybe a little bit more in Sting's case. But they're just flying around the ring and leaping off the top rope and doing stuff that we really didn't see in America at that time. So, yeah, I thought Sting and Muta were like the perfect complements to each other.
Mm-hmm. This is like your no disrespect to the guys of the time. This is like when they were a mid-card feud kind of thing. This because they were battling over a TV title. They weren't battling for the heavyweight title yet. But yeah, Muda was like nothing I had ever seen before. I had never seen the way the man moved around the ring with the kicks and the flipping and, you know, the green mist and all that. And yeah, these were because you had Funk and Flair at the top of the card, but these guys were this was your middle of the pay-per-view match that's going to heat up the crowd, and you got to put that, I don't know, PN News Ranger Ross match or something right after it to cool the crowd down, because these guys are just going to elevate you so much. It's like being a DJ. You know, when you're a DJ, you're playing your music, and you got to go your beats per minute, go up, up, up. Now, these guys were your high. This is like your high-energy dance song. And then you had to throw on that, oh, we're going to slow it down for a minute, like all the lovers, you know, do their little slow dance right before we go back up a bit to the main event. It was just, yeah, it was insane, and it was just a back and forth. You know, you didn't really see that much then. It was a very even feud until Muda gets the upper hand in the end.
Yeah, and then again, like, they were, and that's where, like, we're getting close to maybe one of my favorite matches in WCW history, and that is the Thunderdome cage match at Halloween Havoc 89, where you've got Funk and Muda versus Sting and Flair. And you're right, like, Funk and Flair is the headlining match, but then we've got this really hot undercard feud, and Flair, much like Dusty, knows a way to elevate myself is by elevating these young dudes. And so we get Funk and Muda and Flair and Sting, and like, that is one of my favorite matches just because it just works. Like, you've got these two great veterans, but you've also got like the guys that are coming up next. Plus we get the great spot where the cage catches on fire because something always goes wrong in WCW, and Muda has to put out the fire with his mist.
I have to look that up. Hopefully that's on WWE Network.
Yeah, I think, I forget if it's Shivani or who's the lead announcer, but they're like, the cage is on fire, and then Muda just out of nowhere just climbs up and sprays mist at the flames to put him out, and he actually gets a baby face pop from the crowd.
That's awesome. I remember this, what led up to this, because, you know, I used to watch the Superstation. TBS sometimes had those lines going through, those light white lines that were a little thick that would go down the screen a little bit. But I remember, you know, this is when they came together, because I remember, I think Doug Dillinger went in there, and I remember hearing Jim Ross going, Dillinger's a civilian. Why are they putting their hands on him?
Yep.
Good old Doug Dillinger.
Good old Doug Dillinger. Like, Dillinger stayed in that company forever.
I know.
Dillinger was still there in 2000.
Yes, he was. He was there till the end. So just going to kind of put a bow on this part of Sting's career. So we've talked about the Thunderdome cage match between the two teams, which Flair and Sting won at Halloween Havoc. The alliance resulted in Sting joining a newly formed and now face Four Horsemen, along with the Andersons, Arn and Ole. Sting finished out the year by winning a four-man round-robin Iron Man tournament at Starrcade 89. In the final match of the night, Sting defeated Flair to accumulate the necessary points to win the tournament. The victory had made him the number one contender for Flair's NWA world title, leading to tension within the Four Horsemen. So we're going to pause there and kind of talk about this era, you know, put a bow on it. So first question, though, is what's your opinion of Face Horsemen? Because I'm not a fan of it.
I think it worked for the story that they were telling here.
Yes, for the brief variety. It was like an end to a mean.
It's like the, I forget, is it Sylvester? Like it's one of the old Looney Tunes cartoons where he thinks he's eating Tweety, but he ends up eating a bomb and yes. He blows up and he goes to heaven. And he's like, yeah, it's a neat trick. The only problem is I can only do it once.
Oh, the Daffy Duck. It was Daffy and Bugs, actually.
Daffy, okay.
Yes.
And so yeah, that's how I feel about Face Horsemen. Like, it's a neat trick, but you can only do it if you have the absolute right circumstances. And, like, coming off of the Funk feud, obviously, if Flair's a face, then the Horsemen have to be faces. And so I liked how they set things up going into Starrcade 89, the Future Shock tournament, which gets a bad rap from a lot of people, but I thought it was like, I applaud them for thinking outside of the box and going with the whole round robin tournament. It just probably didn't, the execution, I think, hurt them. But I think with Sting, this feud right here, like with when Sting joins the Horsemen, this is the first of many times where we will see Sting's Achilles heel, Andy Atherton.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does Sting trust people too much?
Yes.
Yes. Sting is, I'm not going to go as far as to say the man is gullible, but he is far too trusting.
That is true. That becomes a pattern in the man called Sting's career. So what do you think of his gear at the time? Now, he was wearing, he had the long pants, right? And he had the little tail, the blonde hair with the tail, right?
Yeah, he had the little rat tail, and he had the paint, but it was a much more simplified version mm-hmm. of the paint. And then, like, I think we got to see a variety of colors, but it wasn't as colorful as it would be in the 90s. Like, he had his black trunks, he had his green trunks, he had his pink trunks, but it wasn't like when we get to the Great American Bash where Sting's got like the red, white, and blue America outfit,
yes.
which might be one of Sting's best outfits ever. Like, we're not to that level yet. So I think, like, we're seeing the early stages of what Sting would become.
Mm-hmm. So what's your favorite match of this era?
It's got to be one of the Sting Muda matches, and then if not one of those, it's the Thunderdome match. And like closely following that would be Clash 1, just because it's a great match, but also it's historically significant. But just as a fan, like, I love that Thunderdome match so much, and then I love the Sting Muda matchup so much that I think I would grade those just a hair higher on my list than even the Clash of the Champions match.
All right. What'd you think of the music? Now, he was coming out to Turbocharge at the time, I think it's called, with that guitar riffs and all that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think of that? That was because that was during the time of generic WCW music.
Yeah, like, as far as generic WCW music goes or NWA music goes at the time, it wasn't bad. And it actually fit the characters. Like, it fit the character's thing. Like, there were far worse generic NWA themes,
yes,
on this card, but yeah, I think they found one that actually fit with who Sting was, with who the character of Sting was at the time.
Yeah, you kind of believe that this guy, you know, like he looked like he came out to that music kind of thing.
Yeah, and then they're like playing up on the, they're not quite to surfer Sting yet, but they're mm-hmm. playing up on like, this is he's a wild, crazy Californian Andy. You don't know what this man's going to do.
You know what's funny is I had never heard of Venice Beach, California before in my life. And then I hear Hulk Hogan getting introduced from there. Then I hear Sting getting introduced. I'm like, whoa, Venice Beach must be producing somewhere. Is that where like wrestlers come from? I don't know. Is that like to the consequences?
Throw them out there.
So, and agreed, you know, his signature feud during this time is with the Great Muda.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, even more so than Flair, because I think like he had a couple really great matches with Flair in this time period, but I don't think we fully get the rivalry until the 90s.
All right. So then we move on to what we're calling the next part of Sting's career is his feud with the Horsemen from 90 and 91. I remember this coming out on Clash Champions 10, Texas Shooting, February 6, 1990. They all come out and Ole basically says, "It's over. You're done. You know, relinquish the title shot," or, you know, they basically booted him out and attacked him. Later that evening, he gets attacked and he suffered a legit knee injury
yep.
while interfering in a steel cage match between featuring the Horsemen. It forced the Bookers to find a new opponent for Flair at the forthcoming Wrestle War pay-per-view event, which just happened to be Lex Luger. During the match between Flair and Luger, Sting came down to motivate Luger to come back and beat Flair. Before this, Sting and Luger had been at odds. When Luger was close to winning, Sting was attacked by Ole Anderson. Luger opted to save the already injured Sting and ended up losing the match by countout while assisting his friend. Behind the scenes, WCW had wanted Flair to drop the title to Luger at Wrestle War, but Flair refused, saying he had promised Sting that he would hold the title until he could return from his injury. Despite the injury, though, Sting was still utilized on television and pay-per-views when necessary.
And again, that shows you how much respect Flair had for Sting.
Yeah, I mean, you don't see that. Unless your last name is Levesque, you don't stay on TV with an injury.
Yeah, like, and players like, no, I'm not going to drop the belt to Luger, even though, like, that would have been a big deal for the fans at the time. He's like, you know, this is the next guy, and we're going to wait till we get to the next guy. And, like, another thing about wrestling, Andy, is that wrestling can also be educational. Mm-hmm. Because even though this was a legit knee injury, the injury that they said on TV for this angle was the Horseman had ruptured Sting's patella tendon. And this is the first time I had ever heard of the patella tendon. And to this day, I know what a patella tendon is because of that man called Sting. Because they got the most out of this injury. I think other than a certain Hollywood cameo we'll talk about here in a second, Andy, mm-hmm. I think they did a good job keeping Sting in the fans' minds while he was injured. And, like, they really garnered sympathy for him by having him, you know, show up with the crutches and giving updates on his status and stuff that they really don't do in wrestling nowadays.
No, it's all about, you know, what. Well, right now it doesn't really count because we're in a weird period. But it's yeah, they don't play the long game as much. Like we've mentioned already, you know, Sting was a benefit of the long game. You know, he was not a short term solution, yeah. And he, you know, was seen as a guy that should be you should be built around. That we're going to wait for him. Flair knew that. Dusty knew that. They all knew that. So it's funny too. You mentioned that wrestling beard. The late great Gorilla Monsoon taught me many medical terms that I had no idea what a trapezius muscle was.
Yes,
or you know,
the lower lumbar region,
exhibital protuberous, or whatever the hell you used to say. You know, and Piper's yes, and in the head too. So yes, wrestling is educational as much as people think it's not. So at Capital Combat in May of that year, Sting was accosted by the Horsemen and thrown into a metal cage at ringside. In a promotional crossover, Sting was rescued by his buddy RoboCop. Mm. After his injury, he defeated, finally, Flair for the NWA World title on July 7th, 1990, at the Great American Bash. He went on to feud with title contenders Flair and Sid Vicious. Vicious had appeared to defeat Sting in a title match at 1990 Halloween Havoc, but the Sting that Vicious pinned was revealed to be an imposter played by Horseman Barry Windham. The real Sting appeared soon after and pinned Vicious to retain his title after the match was restarted. During his title run, a masked man...
Oh, wow. It just hit me, Andy, that we're recording this on the anniversary of Sting's first title win.
Wow, look at that. See, sometimes...
July 7th.
30 years ago to the date. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then again, that's the iconic red, white, and blue Sting.
Yes, with the lapel, with the, what you call it, with the shoulder pads, whatever those things are called.
Yeah, he's got like a Michael Jackson jacket on. Yeah.
Yes, it was very late 80s, early 90s. I'll tell you. You know, during his title run, a masked man known as the Black Scorpion would taunt and attack Sting on many occasions. The feat culminated in a final showdown between Sting and the Black Scorpion at Starrcade Collision Course in December. The cage match ended with Sting pinning an unmasking Scorpion who turned out to be Flair in disguise. So, pause there for a moment. So when the team came to the Black Scorpion, what'd you think of that whole thing?
Even as a young Stinger, as a little Stinger, Andy, I knew that this angle was bogus. I knew that they weren't hitting on anything with the Black Scorpion. You know, I didn't know it was going to end up being Ric Flair.
Really?
I don't know if the company knew that it was going to end up being Ric Flair, honestly, because it's like you have enough history already between these two guys that if you wanted to go back to Flair and Sting, you could just give us Flair and Sting. We'd be like, okay, cool. Like, there was no need for all the smoke and mirrors, literally. There was no need for Ole Anderson with the voice modulator. Like, it just didn't work. And this is the first of, again, this 1990s period. We'll see a lot of things, good and bad, about Sting that become set in stone during his WCW run. And one of them is the company doesn't protect Sting like they should. Like, they did a good job getting him there, Andy. Mm-hmm. But once he's there, once he's at that level, they really didn't do a good job of protecting this guy like you would protect the top guy.
Yes. I mean, I remember this at the time briefly, but it wasn't telegraphed like, you know, who the higher power was. You know, yeah. You pretty much knew it was going to be, it's me, it's me. You had an inkling that it was going to end up being Flair, but like you said, it didn't need to be Flair. You know, it just give us the guys. They don't even need a reason. They're, just because they're Sting and Flair. That's all.
Yeah.
So you would say Flair, though, is his main rival, his signature feud during this time?
Yeah. During this early 90s period, it's definitely Flair. Like, they, once he gets back from the injury and gets back on track, gets the title, you know, has that great moment at the Great American Bash, like Flair, to his credit, Ric Flair did right by Sting.
All right, and then what's your favorite match, you think, even though?
You gotta be that Great American Bash match.
Yeah.
Because that's not only is that a great match, but it's kind of like every Sting Flair match, and this is gonna sound like I'm being critical of the Mandy, mm-hmm. but I'm not. Like, because every Sting Flair match is pretty much the same, with just a wrinkle thrown in here or there, but they're all good.
Yes. Yeah, they all have a little different tinge to it, but they're you know, somewhat predictable. I mean, you know, a lot of wrestlers' matches, you could say that about Shawn and Bret. You know, you could say that about, you know, Hogan and Savage. They, a lot of their matches were great, but they were very similar. There was very few differences, and the differences depended on what role each guy was in, who may have been involved on the outside, what the motivations were, but the matches in between the ropes usually were very same during these legendary feuds. So we move on to 91 through 93, where Sting's first championship reign ended on January 11th in 1991, when he lost the belt back to Flair in a rematch from Starrcade the same month. WCW seeded from the National Wrestling Alliance and became World Championship Wrestling. Sting took part in the WCW World Heavyweight Championship and Tag Team Championship. Sting then took part in what considered to be the best match in 91, teaming with Luger to face the Steiner Bros as Super Brawl 1, a pay-per-view for the World Tag Team titles. The Steiners won by pinfall after Nikita Koloff, who had been feuding with Luger, interfered in the match by swinging a chair at Luger but hitting Sting instead. Consequently, Sting feud with Nikita Koloff through the summer of 91, and in August 91, Sting defeated Steve Austin to win a tournament for the vacated WCW United States Heavyweight Championship. Sting held the title for 86 days before losing it to Ric Flair at Clash of Champions 17. Sorry, I'm having trouble tonight reading Roman numerals.
Yeah, this is like the period of Sting's career where we see maybe some of the best in-ring stuff, even mm-hmm. though like he's at a point where he doesn't have that athleticism anymore. Like, he's still athletic, more athletic than you or I or any of the people watching at home, but compared to what he was in 88 or 89 going up against Muda, like, that explosiveness is not as explosive.
Yes.
But like he's getting in there with Flair, you know, he's getting in there with Nikita Koloff. Like, they had a hell of a feud, you know, he's getting in there with somebody like Steve Austin. So I think this is the time period where we're starting to see Sting become a more well-rounded wrestler.
And this is during the time when we had the Stings with the Dudes with the Bad Attitudes had been right before this, right?
Yeah, around. Dudes with the Attitudes versus, we got the Dangerous Alliance, we got Sting Squadron.
Yes, speaking of those two groups you just mentioned, at Starrcade 91, Sting won the first ever Battle Bowl Battle Royal, for which he received a Battle Bowl Championship ring. He then became embroiled in a feud with the Dangerous Alliance, which was headed by Paul E. Dangerously. The stable targeted Sting because he was the so-called franchise of WCW, and the Alliance vowed to destroy both Sting and the promotion he was the face of. At the same time, Sting was being targeted by Luger, who had once again turned heel as WCW champion. He viewed Sting as a threat. Sting engaged in many matches with the Dangerous Alliance members, especially Rick Rude, who was the group's biggest star. Mm-hmm. It was during this feud that Sting won the first of his six WCW World Heavyweight Championships, defeating Luger on February 29th in 92 at Super Bowl II. The feud ended when Sting formed Sting Squadron, consisting of allies Ricky Steamboat, Dustin Rhodes, Windham, and Koloff, and they defeated the Alliance, Rude, Austin, Arn, Zabisco, and Bobby Eaton in a War Games match at WrestleWar in May 92. Dave Meltzer had awarded the match his highest rating of 5 stars. Near the end of Sting's battles with the Dangerous Alliance, the seeds were sown for what became arguably one of the most famous feuds of Sting's career. Sting defended his WCW world title on April 12th, 1992, in the Omni in Atlanta against 450-pound Big Van Vader. During the match, Vader splashed Sting, cracking three of his ribs and rupturing his spleen. Sting recovered and defended his title on July 12th against Vader at the Great American Bash, dropping the belt this time to Big Van Vader after missing a Stinger splash. He hit his head on the ring post and received a powerbomb. After beating Cactus Jack in a False Count Anywhere match at Beach Blast, the WCW newcomer Dick Roberts in a Coal Miner's Glove match at Halloween Havoc, Sting defeated Vader, who had lost the WCW World Heavyweight Championship in August in the King of Cable tournament at Starrcade. So
many tournaments in mid-90s WCW.
Yes, tournaments and groups with ridiculous names. That feud would continue to 93. With Vader, who was again WCW World Heavyweight Champion, who defeated Sting in a bloody strap match at Super Brawl 3. Sting exacted revenge by beating Vader for the championship on March 11th in London, England, but lost it back to Vader 6 days later in Dublin, Ireland. Sting then teamed with WCW newcomer Davey Boy Smith to beat the team of Vader and Vicious at Bash at Beach Blast. So many beaches and blashes and bashes in their names, too. In a match that was set up by a mini-movie in which had an evil midget blow up Sting's boat. At the end of 93, Sting was one of the first people to congratulate Flair, who had just returned from the World Wrestling Federation after his WCW title victory over Vader at Starrcade. So this was quite a bit going on in a short period of time here. What did you think of this period of time? Now, this is where we have the man called Sting music enter the equation, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because this is coming off of, I want to say 92 was when the Slam Jam album came out. Mm-hmm. The classic feat of musical achievement where we get classics like Don't Step to Ron for Ron Simmons, or Ricky Steamboat Family Man, which is Ricky Steamboat's theme. And then also on that, like you said, is Man Called Sting, which I feel like this period of Sting's run in WCW, like 91 through about 93, 94 maybe, like early 90s through whenever Hogan shows up.
Yeah.
Like that's maybe the peak of Sting in terms of Sting as a performer, Sting as an all-around wrestler. In terms of the caliber of opponents, because like you said, just that list where we got Flair, we've got Vader, we've got Luger, we've got Koloff, we've got Steve Austin, we've got Rick Rude, like so many great opponents for Sting during this time period. I think this might have been the peak of Sting, at least in WCW.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So many matchups, you know, like you said, Rick Rude, you know, Flair comes back, Vader, Zabisco, Arn, I mean, everybody. I mean, this was a time, Sting was very busy during this period of time. What do you think his best match, though, of this time? What's your favorite match?
I think I'll have to agree with your man, Dave Meltzer, and give a shout-out to that Wrestle War match, the War Games between Sting Squadron and the Dangerous Alliance. I'll give that a shout out. I'll also give a shout out to, and I don't know which one I would go with, but certainly one of the Sting Luger matches, because I always thought they had really good chemistry either as a tag team or as opponents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this was like peak Dick Luger as a heel.
Yeah,
like he was just an asshole during this.
Yeah, not only was he a great heel, but he was also like people like to take shots at Lex Luger, but from like 88 to 94 maybe, like I thought Luger was actually pretty good in ring.
Yeah, before he became too lumbering. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, before he got too big and bulky, and then it was downhill from there. But when Luger was just like reasonably unattainably muscle bound, like, he was actually really good, particularly when you put him in there with somebody like a Flair or like a Steamboat or a Sting who could just bump around for him.
Yeah. Yeah, Luger wasn't
a Pillman. Like, I think Luger and Pillman had some really good matches back in 89.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Luger was always better with smaller opponents, I think. when he's the guy that's got to do all the bulk of the moving, it doesn't go so well for him.
No.
So what do you think his signature feud, though, is of this period?
I think I would, like, there's a lot of good answers. I think I'm going to give it a tie, though. I think for the early part of the period, it's Flair, definitely. Mm-hmm. But then those Sting Vader matches, like, you can't discount those. So I'll say Vader and Flair were his biggest feuds.
All right.
And so, those are some hard, like, go back and watch some of those Sting Vader matches. They're just hard hitting, like, slugfest. Because if you know anything about Big Van Vader, like, he's not here to play nice with you in that ring. Everything is stiff with Vader, and Sting was the guy for that. Like, Sting wanted the smoke, so they were good dance partners.
Yeah, a good big man, not so big man rivalry, I think. And then, you know, we know what happened with Vader and WWE, which we won't talk about that now. And Sting continued to feud with Vader and then Rude through the first half of 94. He then won the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship from Rick Rude, but Rude recaptured the title on May 1st at Wrestling Dontaku in Japan in 94. The decision was reversed, however, because Rude had allegedly hit Sting with the title belt during the match. This was to cover up a real-life back injury that Rick Rude sustained in the match that forced Rude into retirement. Sting refused to have the title handed to him and instead defeated Vader for the vacant WCW International World Heavyweight Championship at Slamboree. Soon after, Flair defeated Sting in a title unification match at Clash of Champions 27, turning heel in the final moments of the match when Sensuous Sherry turned on Sting and took Flair's side. Sting spent the second half of 94 and most of 95 teaming with his new arrival, Hulk Hogan, in his battles against Kevin Sullivan's Three Faces of Fear and its successor stable, the Dungeon of Doom. So, we'll pause there for a second. So, you're Steve Borden, you're Sting, you're the face of WCW, because, you know, you're a little higher on the pecking order than Luger. Flair had gone over to WWF for a little while. What are you thinking when Hogan arrives?
Here's where I think Sting was probably too nice for his own good. Mm-hmm. Because it felt like Sting was in for anybody that follows the NBA, WCW at this time is the Miami Heat. Like, they're trying to acquire all this talent, but you've already got a superstar in Dwayne Wade on your roster, and Sting is Dwayne Wade. And now we're bringing in LeBron James. And so with the Heat, Dwayne Wade took a step back and he said, I'll be Batman. I'll be Robin, LeBron can be Batman. And that's what Sting did with Hulk Hogan. Like, it's almost like he gave up the spot too easily.
Yeah.
Like, if this were Flair, I don't think we get that. Like, I don't think, you know, obviously Flair and Hogan have their battles when Hogan arrives, but I think if Flair were in the Sting position where he were the top star in the company, I think that transition is much less smooth, because Flair is, like, I think Flair ultimately would let Hogan get his shine, but I don't think he's going to allow himself to become an afterthought. And Sting, unfortunately, once we get to 94 and into 95, becomes an afterthought because Hulk Hogan just sucks up all the oxygen in the room.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It was a little... Yeah, I mean... I don't know about the contract situation. That's a Tim Capel specialty. But, you know, Sting probably wouldn't have jumped. Do you think he could have jumped at that time?
If there were any time for him to jump, this would have been the time.
Yeah, because he would have been a megastar over in
WWE. Vince would have pushed him to the moon.
Yes. I mean, imagine him and Bret, him and Shawn, him and Undertaker. I mean... It would have been insane. If he was on the other side during the Monday Night Wars,
yeah,
I don't think it would have been a war.
Because you figure you got all those guys you mentioned, plus Rock, Stone Cold, mm-hmm. Foley, and you throw Sting into that mix. Like, yeah, it's like the NWO was hot, but even the NWO, I don't think, would be able to turn back that star power that would have happened if Sting goes over to the other side.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, At the Great American Bash in 95, Sting defeated Meng to win another tournament. We love the, love those tournaments over there. WCW United States Heavyweight Championship. He then defeated Meng in a rematch at the Best of the Beach 95. He was on the first ever Monday Nitro in a match where Flair defeated Sting by disqualification as a result of a run-in by Arn Anderson, who attacked Flair. At Fall Brawl, Sting teamed with Hogan and Luger and Randy Savage to defeat the Dungeon of Doom, consisting of Kamala, Zodiac, Shark, and Meng in the event's War Games match. In October 95, Flair convinced Sting to team with him in a match against Arn Anderson and Brian Pillman at Halloween Havoc. Anderson and Pillman attacked Flair earlier in the night, rendering Flair unable to come out for the first part of the match. Sting fended off his opponents until Flair emerged. Later in the match, Flair turned on Sting and reformed the Four Horsemen with Anderson and Pillman, and later adding Chris Benoit to fill out the group. Sting then defeated Flair in a subsequent Nitro with the Scorpion Deathlock, refusing to let go until Luger persuaded him to do so. He defeated Flair again at World War III. Later in the night, Sting competed in the World War III Battle Royal for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship, which was won by Macho Man Randy Savage. Sting's alliances with Hogan and Savage led to the Horsemen attack them as well. Sting's second U.S. title reign lasted until November 13th, when he was defeated by Kintsugi Sasaki in Japan. At Starrcade, Sting then defeated Sasaki, representing New Japan Pro Wrestling in a non-title match to win the World Cup of Wrestling for WCW. The next match of that night, Sting lost a triangle match involving Flair and Luger. Flair had won by countout to become the number one contender for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship, which Flair won from Savage in the next match. So what do you think of this time period? Sting kind of fell down the card a little bit because, you know, he's wrestling Flair, he's at the top, and now he's wrestling Meng.
This is easily one of my least favorite periods of Sting's career in WCW. And more than that, like, this is probably 94, 95, mm-hmm. and 2000, like, are probably my least favorite years in WCW history. Just because we get a Hogan in the company now, and it's a Hogan that nobody wants. Like, we're getting the WWF's leftovers, if you're a WCW fan. Like, this is a red and yellow, real American Hulk Hogan that is already played out and tired by the time he arrives. And it's not until he joins the New World Order that Hogan actually becomes interesting again.
Well, he's not real American. He's American made.
Yes, he's the Jimmy Hart equivalent to real American.
Yes. He's American made. God, that was so bad. That thing. So what do you think his signature feud was at this time?
This is a tough one just because, like, the first half of 94 is pretty decent with Vader and Flair and stuff. And then once Hogan comes in, we see the slide. So I guess I'd still go with Flair. Is probably his biggest feud in that match. The title unification match at Clash 27 mm-hmm. is probably maybe the standout match from this time period. But it's not a great time period for Sting.
No, it's not, like you said, a great time for WCW. Now, what's your favorite match, though?
Probably that match at Clash 27.
Okay.
The unification match, just because I think that was a good match, because Flair and Sting can't have a bad match. Like, it's impossible. They'll have a match on WCW that we'll talk about later on in the 2000s, and it's not a great match, but it's still a good match because of Sting and Flair. But also, this match is important because it kind of, like, the WCW title scene, as you just read, Tim, like, just a mess.
Yes.
Like, so many tournaments, so many unification matches. You know, we've got this deal with Japan that fell through, and so we got to figure out a situation. Rick Rude's hurt his back, and now he can't, you know, compete in the match. So, you know, having Sting and Flair unify this title clears up a lot of unnecessary clutter in their title picture.
Yes. And speaking of clutter, though, it's about to get a bit more cluttered in WCW in the form of the New World Order. But we're going to take a break, though, right before we talk about that. So we're going to continue on with the man called Sting's career in just a moment, hanging here with the Godfather, Nate Milton. I'm Andy Athan on episode 3 of Evolution. Stick around. Be right back. Place to Be Nation, welcome back to episode 3 of The Evolution. This episode, we're talking about Sting with the Godfather, Nate Milton. We're going to get back to talking about the great Steve Borden's career. But first, let's kind of talk about what's going on here at Place to Be Nation Wrestling. Over lots of great shows here. The Place to Be podcast, The Mothership, which is every other Monday night, co-hosted by JT Rosero and Scott Criscolla, takes you chronologically through the history of WWE. Nate, you can hear Nate every other week on The Main Event, which is he co-hosts with Scott Criscolla and Steve Willey, breaking down all of the current events in the world of wrestling. Row 1, Seat 1, which is an interesting look at the small town wrestling and beyond with host Ben Zani. Talking WCW has the Center Stage Theater with Tim Capel, Greg Phillips, and Jennifer Smith pay tribute to the legendary promotion from the Dirty South, Body Pressure Luck, which I am involved with. I am the third man in the booth. It's a wrestling game show hosted by JT Rosero and Jordan Duncan with This Ring, in which husband and wife Ryan and Cindy Everett discuss specific matches and their respective fandoms. The NWA Saturday Special, where Scott Criscolla and Dr. G. George Rubellino talk about current and classic National Wrestling Alliance. And don't forget about other shows like Jenny and the Gems, PTB NXT, Abs Division, Special Relations, and much, much more. Over on the Place Nation pop feed, you can hear lots of great shows that I am on. That's my normal home. That's Year in Pop, Laugh in Theater, Great Debate, the Glenn Butler Podcast, Era Spectacular, Diamond Conversations, It Was a Thing on TV, A Piece of the Action, Blockbuster Rewind, much, much more. While you're at, subscribe to a pair of tremendous podcast feeds. First, Jennifer Smith, The Jenny Position, which is the home of Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Driving, Brother Sister Rewatch, The Journey Through Infinity, and much, much more. And also, The North-South Connection, brought to you by JT Rosero, Chad Campbell, and Aaron George, the official home for Wrestling Warzone, No Holds Barred, The Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jeff Learns Wrestling, The Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast, Teen Ever Dies, and much, much more. And Nate, this is right in your wheelhouse. We've officially kicked off our 2020 stretch project, determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have till New Year's Eve to do research, promote matches, and build your list. Conversation rules can be found on Facebook under the WCW matches page or on the pro-only message board. And don't forget to check out the lots of stuff on PlaceMation.com each and every day. We have new voices, fresh takes, bringing you articles and topics of the world of wrestling, sports, pop culture, including Trent, SmackDown, Fox Report, This Week in WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Ben's Unpopular Opinion, Matt's Disney live action journey, and don't forget veteran columns like Glenn Butler's Wednesday Walker on the Web. And on social media pages, our newest tournament is up and running, off to a tremendous start. It is the greatest song from a movie tournament. As of this recording, we have gone through the first round matchups of the Kellerman's region. Kellerman's the resort featured in Dirty Dancing. Each bracket is named after one of the signature songs featured in that bracket, the place where it took the setting, so to speak. So we're starting the Glenbrook North High School region. Nate, what do you think so far of the early matchups? Any surprises? Anything you're happy with, not happy with so far?
I mean, this is going to be a tough tournament. Like, I looked at some of the matchups. I voted on some of the matchups, Andy, and, like, out of the gate, like, honestly, because when Scott and I first started talking on the main event about this tournament, one of the songs that we said is got to be in the final four is When Doves Cry from Purple Rain. And the first round matchup of When Doves Cry is it's Hard Out There Before a Pimp, which won a Grammy. And it's like, oh, both of these songs are great, but I had to cast my vote for Prince, but it wasn't. Actually, I think I cast my vote for It's Hard Out There for a Pimp because I knew Prince was going to win. But I wanted to show the Grammy winners some love. But there's some really interesting matchups. There's some tough matchups. There's some songs I'd forgotten about. There's some songs that like I hadn't remembered or listened to in years, like Tal Bachman, She's So High. Like, I don't even think Tal Bachman remembers that. The only time he remembers that song is when he gets the royalty check in the mail every month.
From She's Had a Mighty. Yeah, this is so wide open. You're going to see some crazy matchups. There are some tough matchups. I mean, it's fairly random. I'm going to say that. I'm not going to tell tales out of school. But, I mean, like, you know, we had two Dirty Dancing songs go up. She's Like the Wind versus... Yep. Hungry Eyes, and in my opinion, Hungry Eyes is head and shoulders above that.
Yeah.
No disrespect on the late Patrick Swayze, tremendous song, but Hungry Eyes is outside of Time of Your Life. That's the signature song for that movie. We also had another matchup go up today: Circle of Life from Lion King go up against How Far I'll Go from Moana. That is a tough draw for the Moana song because that's a very underrated movie with great songs. In fact. We are, and you're going to talk about this at some point on the Rocky Maya VF Picture Show because it features the great Dwayne Johnson as Maui in that.
Yeah,
role.
That's the thing. Like, How Far I Go is a great song, but I think this would be a tougher choice if it was Circle of Life versus You're Welcome.
Yes, and You're Welcome is in the tournament.
Because You're Welcome to me is kind of the stand. Like, all the songs are great because they're Lin-Manuel Miranda. Like, a guy who's having a hell of a week with Hamilton on Disney+. But, like, You're Welcome to me was the song I walk out of the theater singing 2 or 3 days later. So, like, to me, that versus Circle of Life would be, and who knows, we might have to get to that matchup down the road, Andy.
Well, we're not going to see You're Welcome for a while because it's in the Rydell High region, which is the last of the regions that we're going to see in the first round. But I could tell you what song it's going to go up against. It is going to go up against the song Dreaming of You by the late great Selena from the movie Selena.
Oh, that's a great song.
And that's going to be a tough matchup for
those are two very different
yeah.
very different objectives those songs are trying to convey.
Yes. So we'll have a little bit of fun. I know you guys like to do this on Main Event stuff. These matchups will probably be all said and done and will be moved on by the time you all are listening. But let's kind of go through and let's see what Nate's going to say about some of these matchups. So we're going to talk about the Glenbrook North High region. We got Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds from The Breakfast Club versus We Don't Need Another Hero by Tina Turner from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Oh, We Don't Need Another Hero is underrated, but I think Don't You Forget About Me is probably going to have a good run through this mm-hmm. tournament. So I'll go with The Breakfast Club on this one.
Yes. There's not a lot of songs that are going to take down that. Don't You Forget About Me. Here's an interesting matchup. Part of Your World by Jody Benson from Little Mermaid versus Ain't No Mountain High Enough by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell from Remember the Titans. Now this song, though, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. See, here was the decision that I had to make along with the committee. There are songs that are featured in a number of movies. We could have gone with Guardians of the Galaxy. But I think this part is a pivotal moment of Remember the Titans. Because this is when the team really starts to bond in the locker room. And they have this sing-along. So, you know, it's fun at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy after, you know, they put the Power Stone away and they're leaving, you know, damn planet, whatever the damn planet is. I forget what it's called. Nova. When they leave in Nova. It's a great song to end the movie with. But, you know, it really belongs in this tournament for Remember the Titans.
Yeah, that's a great distinction because had you not said from Remember the Titans, I think, because they're both really important songs, but I think Part of Your World is the signature song from The Little Mermaid other than Under the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So before you said Remember the Titans, I was going to go Little Mermaid, but the fact that you made it Ain't No Mountain High Enough from Remember the Titans, to me, that gives it the edge. Because you're right, that song is so important to the scene and the story they're telling at that time.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're trying to go for here. We know people are going to vote for which song they like better or whatever. You know, you got to there was a matchup. There was that a lot of people had trouble with, which was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which a lot of us grew up watching, versus Fallen from Judgment Night. You know, you got to, you know, a lot of people had to go with what they felt like, and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang ended up winning that one. For me, actually, Fallen has some personal college fraternity kind of
things. Yeah, I went with Fallen just because I think that entire soundtrack is underrated from Judgment Night, particularly like with what it was trying to do with the blending of heavy metal and rap music. And like that whole soundtrack is great. So I was one of the few, I think, that went with Fallen in that matchup.
So did I. But at first I was going to go Party Your World, but I've actually convinced myself to go with Ain't No Mountain High Enough. Because, you know, that's really, like I said, that's our hope, is that you look at the matchup and you say, okay, you know, which song, you know, you hear that song, what do you think of? Do you think of that movie? Do you think of that? Or do you just think of the song? And, you know, sometimes in a tiebreaker, you just pick which one you like better. But that's kind of what the theme of this tournament, or the hope of the tournament, is. Our next matchup, Arthur's Theme, which is Best You Can Do by Christopher Cross from the movie Arthur, versus Alabama Song, a.k.a. Whiskey Bar, The Doors from The World's End, the great Nick Frost Simon Pegg movie, where they go on a bar crawl, which I'm going to have to go. I mean, I don't know. The Arthur's Theme is great, but the way they walk down the street after they kind of know something's up in The World's End, and they have the way the Doors song is going with the way they're walking. Yeah, I'm sitting here convincing myself of my votes before I even post the matchups.
See, here's where I'm not familiar with The World's End.
Well, here's the thing, but I could tell you though, if you're not familiar, one thing we do is you go on the Placement Nation Tournament's Facebook page, not the group, not on the Placement Nation page where we share them all, but if you go on the Placement Nation Tournament's page, in the comments, we will post the YouTube link to the scene so that you can see what we're talking about, see the context, or hear the song if you're not even familiar. So we're here to help.
I think that's a valuable tool for everybody participating in the tournament. But just given with my knowledge base right now, Andy, I have to give it to Chris Cross just for the fact that when I was growing up, and I know you probably saw these commercials too, at about 1 in the morning, there was always the Time Life Christopher Cross Collection commercial where we got Think of Laura, Arthur's Theme, Sailing. And I was like, you know what? I don't know who this kind of schlubby looking dude is that's singing these songs, but I like his voice. It's relaxing and it puts me to sleep. So I'm going with Arthur's Theme.
Mr. Yacht Rock himself.
Yes, Mr. Yacht Rock himself. Like, Sailing takes you away. Andy Atherton.
Yes. All right. And we'll only do four out of the eight matchups so we can get back to talking about Sting. It's Tricky by Run DMC. Now we're going with Can't Hardly Wait with the great scene with Seth Green as Kenny against Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon by Urge Overkill from Pulp Fiction.
Ooh, see, It's Tricky is a better song, but with the, you know, kind of keeping in mind what the song means to the film, I got to go Pulp Fiction on this one.
Yeah, definitely. Urge Overkill was a great band that didn't have a lot of hits. Sister of Anna was one of my favorite, but this scene with Uma Thurman and John Travolta, I mean, as great as the It's Tricky is with Kenny and his two buddies, you got to go with Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon. So check it out. First round, we have eight matchups a day because that alone takes a month. And then we'll get down to probably four and here and there once we go through. And, you know, just have fun, people. Engage in conversations, and hopefully one of your favorite songs or one of your favorite movies wins the tournament. But back to the man called Sting. So as we left, we last were talking about Sting. We were going through his years in WCW in 94, 95 with multiple opponents and everything, and there is a shift in the industry coming. Contracts are ending over up north, and some gentlemen and ladies are starting to make their way down south. So Kevin Nash, Scott Hall show up in WCW. But in 96, Sting's appearance had started to change. He grew his hair longer, darker, replacing the blonde flat top haircut. He wore black tights, with a multicolored scorpion, although occasionally he wore color for once. He teamed with his old friend Lex Luger, who had just returned from the WWF. The duo beat Harlem Heat for the WCW World Tag Team Champions in January of 92 on Nitro. They often retain championships as a result of Luger's cheating tactics, to which Steam remain oblivious. When Luger was temporarily unavailable for WCW Uncensored in March, Harlem Heat member Booker T teamed up with Sting to successfully prevent the title from changing hands. Sting and Booker T developed a mutual relationship that showed itself when Sting and Luger granted Harlem Heat a rematch. During the tag title run, Sting received a world title shot against the Giant at Slamboree in May, but lost after accidental interference from Luger. Harlem Heat eventually won the titles back in January. So, summer of 96, Sting was the first to stand up to the outsiders, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, who had recently competed in WWF, whose alliances and agendas were unclear. They had been infiltrating and causing chaos at WCW events. And then Bash at the Beach happens. So, let's pause there for a second. What do you think of this change in Sting happening?
This might be my, other than like the original, like 88, 89 Sting, this might be my favorite era of Sting right here, where we've still got, you know, the colorful face paint. We still got, you know, a bit of the color left from the Surfer Sting days, but he's grown his hair out longer. It's darker. He's primarily wearing black tights now. Like, I like this look. Like, it's, like the Surfer Sting has matured into a grown ass man Sting, and so yeah, I think this is a phase of Sting's career that a lot of people forget or skip over. But I like it because A, it's a way to keep the character fresh, but it also is like the preamble to the Crow Sting.
That was a great character. Yeah, I remember. You know, everybody changes, everybody evolves. You can't be, you know. The blonde Surfer Sting, that was such an 80s thing. It really was. That he had to kind of change with the times a little bit.
And I love, like, the team with him and Luger, where Sting is still the consummate babyface, and so he's looking out for his friend, but his friend in this case is a scumbag, and Lex Luger, who's still cheating, and Jimmy Hart's like Lex Luger's manager, and Sting doesn't want Jimmy Hart hanging around, and so like you've got Sting and Luger as the tag champs, and they keep winning because they're cheating, but Sting is always distracted when Lex and Jimmy Hart cheat.
Yeah. So, what do you think about the whole, you know, lead up to Bash at the Beach '96? With, you know, there was going to be a third man. You know, you have the team of Sting, Luger, and Savage fighting for WCW. Now, it's funny, too, is because I recently watched this for this whole pay-per-view for the first time in years with our friends Tim Capel, Jacob Williams, and James Grunberg. And it's funny, too, I was the only one out of the four of us that had watched it live because I'm a little bit older than them, and they might have been watching then or whatever. And they were curiously picking my brain on who I thought the third man was going to be, whether there was going to be a turn from the WCW side. Did you watch, do you remember watching Bastard Beach live 96?
I watched the week to week. I wasn't able to watch the pay-per-view live. But yeah, like this was my peak WCW viewing. I think it was most people's peak WCW viewing. In summer of 96, I was a senior in high school, and so like this was this, like the whole NWO story was just perfect for my adolescent brain at that time, where we could almost blur the lines and believe that in a world where contracts don't exist, I guess Hall and Nash just jumped ship and they showed up. And to WCW's credit and the Eric Bischoff's credit, Tim, I almost called you Tim Cable, Andy.
It wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
we could all hope to be as good a man as Tim Cable someday. but I thought that like they did a really good job of blurring the lines. Like, yes, obviously now as adults, Andy, we know what the deal was behind the scenes. But as a kid at that time, they did a great job of kind of tricking you into thinking that this is something that could actually be real, even if just for a second.
Yeah. Did you think it was going to be Hogan, or did you think it was going to be you know, somebody else, or even you know, Luger, Savage, or Sting. I mean, in the match, rewatching the match, you know, you kind of think it's going to be Luger.
Yeah.
Because he gets taken out early. You think maybe he's going to come back as the third man. I'm trying to remember, peek my brain. I think if we thought anybody was going to be, it was going to be Savage. Because we didn't even think Hogan. Because we hadn't seen heel Hogan. You know, he was a heel.
I thought it was going to be Luger
yeah.
at the time.
Mm-hmm. Never.
And the crazy thing is, like, actually, the behind the scenes is it was supposed to be Sting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Sting was originally supposed to join the NWO, and to Sting's credit, I think maybe for the first time since Hogan showed up, Sting was like, it wouldn't make sense for the character. I don't think the fans are going to buy it. And Hogan was like, well, I guess I'll have to do it, brother. And it ended up working out the best for both of them, because I don't think, you know, we talked earlier about how hard it is to make the Road Warriors heels.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that WCW audience would have responded the way they think if you make Sting the leader of the NWO. Because, like, the NWO was already getting cheered enough as it was. And if you put Sting there with Hall and Nash versus the WCW contingent led by Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage, the NWO is so much cooler than the WCW team.
No, yeah, there's no question. They made the right decision. Sting, you know, opened his mouth at the right time. So, I mean, that was tremendous. I mean, we talked about it. Like, you know, Hogan, there was no better choice, because he really elevated Hall and Nash and made the NWO something bigger than they probably ever could have thought it was going to be.
And the WCW fans already wanted to boo this man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we didn't want you from the first place. Like it's like the Bianca Belair line of when Charlotte showed up on NXT. Like, you don't even go here, Hulk Hogan. Like, what are you even doing here? And so the fact that they finally got the message, you know, after trying to kind of stuff Hulk Hogan down the fans' throats for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
it's like, okay, let's turn him. And it was the perfect thing for everybody. Like, it elevated, like you said, Hall and Nash. It elevated Hogan. It's going to literally and figuratively elevate Sting here in a bit, because mm-hmm. he's going to go up to the rafters.
Yes. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have worked out any other way if you don't, because this guy was your heart and soul of WCW, and you couldn't have him be there. Yeah, it made perfect sense. A lot of WCW fans probably sitting there going, Hogan, you came in, you know, lace Flair's boots. What the hell are you doing here? You know, you're no Ric Flair, sir. But he became a bigger heel than Flair probably ever was during his time. So, so the NWO gets formed, and Sting and Luger went up to their rivals, the Four Horsemen members, Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, and asked them to team with them, saying that they needed to put aside the differences for the good of WCW. So Flair and Anderson agreed, and the four wrestlers composed Team WCW at the annual War Games match of Fall Brawl. They will be facing the NWO team of Hall, Nash, Hogan, and a fourth member yet to be determined on Nitro event. However, the NWO played a trick, claiming Sting was on their side. A vignette was shown with Sting's voice being recorded in his limousine as Luger was being lured out to the parking lot. There, a man dressed as Sting, played by Jeff Farmer, attacked him, and the crowd was led to believe that Sting had joined the NWO and the fourth man against a three-man WCW Sting. Sting was then not at that edition of Nitro and showed up at Fall Brawl just as his teammates declared that they would face the NWO themselves because they didn't believe him. Sting told Luger that he did not attack him, but Luger refused to believe him. Later during the match, Sting entered as the fourth and final man for Team WCW after the imposter Sting had entered for the NWO. Once in the ring, Sting immediately took about all the members into the league, or angrily saying, is that good enough for you right there? Is this proof enough? Sting then gave Luger an obscene gesture, a.k.a. the finger, walked out of the match, leaving Team WCW at a 4-on-3 disadvantage, which they did not overcome. And the next night on Nitro, Sting came out unannounced during the middle of the show with no music or entrance pyrotechnics, entered the ring with his back turned to the camera side of the audience, launched into an angry tirade about what had happened over the last week. So,
yeah, this is, like, I love this Sting right here. Like, I think it's a great bit of storytelling in that Sting kept sticking his neck out time and time again for Luger, defending him against, you know, people that say Lex is no good, Lex is cheating and all this stuff. And then the first time where there's some doubt about Sting, Lex flips. Like, Lex folds quicker than a tent. and so there's legitimate anger. Like, Sting is like, I've been the only one out here trying to fight these guys, and now you don't have my back. And we see, like, Sting has a reason to, quote-unquote, turn his back on WCW. And this promo, like, that's another thing I think I didn't mention earlier. Like, if you look at Sting's early promos, there's a lot of energy, mm-hmm. but there's A, not a lot of substance, and B, they're just kind of typical 80s yelling promos, yes. which, like, there's a limit to how much of those promos you can take. So now we get this Sting who's a little bit more secure with his character. He's got a better handle on who the Sting character is, and he gives this really great promo that everybody should look up if you get a chance, where he gives his reason, he gives his rationale, and he doesn't turn his, like, if you listen to the words, he doesn't turn his back on WCW. He says, for everybody that supported me, I support you and I have your back. For everybody that doubted me, you can stick it because I'm a free agent. And I think, like, that's they did a great job of kind of setting up what would become the Crow Sting character. Mm-hmm. And like, I think this is probably, again, this is why this is maybe one of my favorite times in WCW, because not only do we have some good wrestling and some intriguing storylines, but it feels like they actually put thought into this, which is not something we'll always be able to say with WCW.
Yes, that is a very true point. Yes, this is a tremendous promo. Now it's coming back in my brain as I hear you talking about it. This, I mean, I put this up there with the pipe bomb. That is how much impact this promo made. I mean, it's up there. This is probably one of the top 10 promos in wrestling history, I would think. That'd be an interesting poll to do one day. But, yeah, I mean, because
it's an underrated promo, too, because I think, like, we focus so much on how great the Crow character is and the fact that this guy didn't speak for a year mm-hmm. that we forget. Like, one of his last big promos was this right here, explaining exactly what he was going to do.
Yeah. I mean, he basically, you know, basically poured out his heart and, you know, got everything off his chest. And this led up to, you know, where he's going to be for the next year. So just watching and, you know, yes, I'm going to protect you, but you know what? I'm not sticking my neck out if it's not needed kind of thing.
Yep.
So he would visit from time to time. He threw down the mic and then, you know, he showed up in a New Japan Pro Wrestling tournament to defeated Masahiro Chono in the first round, but then was eliminated by Shiro Koshinaka. His last match in 96 took place on September 23rd at the Yokohama Arena, where he and Luger teamed up to defeat Arn Anderson and Stephen Regal. It would end up being his last tour of Japan on October 21st, 1996 edition of Nitro. Sting returned for the first time since the night after Fall Brawl in a match where the imposter Sting was wrestling Mr. JL. Sting emerged wearing a trench coat, white face paint with black marks around the eyes. He went in the ring and attacked the NWO, who was still imitating Sting's old mannerisms from at that point, with his new finisher, the Scorpion Death Drop, which is an inverted DDT.
Yep.
And then he used two jumping elbows, a Stinger Splash, and a Scorpion Deathlock, while the rest of the NWO came to ringside. Rather than intervene, they just stood by and watched, and Sting was done. Ted DiBiase and Kevin Nash came to the ring, made Sting an offer to join the NWO and get back at WCW for betraying him. Sting, after a pause, first called out the NWO Sting as a cheap imitation before telling the NWO that the real Sting may or may not be in your price range, and then concluded by saying, the only thing that's for sure about Sting is that nothing's for sure. And like you said, after that, he would not speak for over a year on WCW programming. He became a silent, almost ghostly Sting carrying baseball bats as a weapon, began appearing in the rafters at WCW events and painting his entire face black with white corpse paint kind of thing, kind of looking like the Crow. In retaliation, yeah. The NWO Sting, who was still imitating Bourne, became painting his face that way as well. And it became a big deal. You saw all those Sting masks in the crowd. So what do you think of this Sting, you know, in the rafters? Now, you said this is one of your favorite, you know, Sting characters or Sting personas of all time. What made it so great?
just the fact that, you know, that sentence that you just mentioned, Andy, this man didn't talk for over a year. Like, we nowadays we see companies that don't have the patience to play out an angle for 6 months,
yeah,
let alone over a year. And you take your biggest star, or one of your biggest stars, who's just coming off of this great promo, and he's got this cool new look, and he's got a cool new finisher with the Scorpion Death Drop, and instead of booking him to wrestle, we book him to sit in the rafters or occasionally show up and have a mask on in the front row. And just the cool ways that they were able to keep Sting front of mind without overexposing him and burning out the gimmick, I thought was really smart on WCW's part. And it just added to the mystique of the character.
Yes, because, you know, he was in that protective role, but the whole time, this was what was so great about this whole storyline. You never knew who was going to show up, who was going to join the NWO, and it was always there about Sting.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't want to see it, but you wanted to see it kind of thing. It was like, what could happen here? Because before, you wouldn't have thought Sting would ever be in the NWO, like the old Sting. But this Sting, this guy's an enigma. This guy, you know, was loyal, and then, you know, he ate a lot of shit for it. And nowadays, you know, he would come down, he would, you know, give the person the bat and then turns back and yep. say, okay, do what you're going to do, you know. And then, you know, eventually, you know, other people started joining. For me, the whole thing about the NWO was I didn't like when I saw certain guys. Like, it did wonders for Buff Bagwell. I'll give him that. The Giant didn't need to be in the NWO. I always thought Scott Norton didn't really know who he was before the NWO. You know, but I always thought the NWO should have been guys that we wrestling fans associate with WWF. That's what made it so great in the beginning when it was, you know, it was Hall, it was Nash, it was Hogan, it was X6, DiBiase, even Vincent, because we knew him as Virgil. You know, we didn't need no Horace Hogan's. We didn't need the Giant. You know, we didn't need, you know, Stevie Ray. You know, these are guys that did not need to be in the NWO.
I think the other great thing about this, and this is why I'll have some negative comments to say about a certain match with one of Scott Crisola's favorite performers later, is that this feud at this time, like I'll already tell you, like what Sting's greatest feud during this time period, it's with the NWO.
Yes.
And that, like, there is such an us versus them mentality that, yeah, like it's the NWO is still cool. And you'll notice, like, the NWO gets cheered against pretty much everybody in WCW at this point, except for Sting and Diamond Dallas Page.
Okay.
Like, those are the only two WCW guys that are still seen as cool by the fans at this time. And I think there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because they're let me think about how to, you know, because they're guys that made their name in WCW. They never left. They never jumped.
Yep.
These were the guys that, you know, these are our guys, basically. You know, you could say that about Flair, but Flair did his stint in WWF. But these are the guys that have been there the whole time.
Same with Luger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Luger, Wyndham, Arn, even, you know, Dusty. I mean, all of them. Everybody took their turn getting paid up in Stanford, you know, except for Sting and DDP up to this point. So then, you know, what happens is, on screen, J.J. Dillon, who was the commissioner of WCW, tried many times to get Sting to return to wrestling by making contracts to fight various NWO members. Sting did not accept any of them, often tearing them up in Dillon's face. Then asked Sting who he wanted to face on Edition of Nitro, and Sting went out to the ringside, picked up a fan sign, pointed to the one name on it, Hogan. Eventually, Sting got his wish. He finally met Hogan in December of that year at Starrcade for the Heavyweight Championship. The finish in the match was supposed to echo the Montreal Screwjob finish that the WWF had used to double-cross Bret Hart just 1 month earlier at their annual Survivor Series event. Nick Patrick, the referee for the contest, was supposed to execute a fast count on Sting, while Hart, who signing with WCW was the linchpin for the Montreal Screwjob, will come out to protest the decision and since he had already served as the guest referee between a match between Larry Zbysko and Eric Bischoff earlier that evening, or the match would be restarted, Sting would emerge victorious by forcing Hogan to submit to the Scorpion Deathlock. However, Patrick did not do his part properly and instead counted the pin at normal speed, which added to an unintentional level of controversy for the finish. The next night on Nitro, Hogan protested the decision, claiming that Patrick's decision should have been considered final and the rematch was granted. The match ran over Nitro's allotted time slot, and the finish was aired later in the week on the inaugural episode of Thunder. Similar to the Starrcade result, two different referees declared two different men as the winner. Later that night, Dillon vacated the World Heavyweight Championship, forcing Sting to surrender the belt. Sting responded with his first words on mic since October of 1996 when he told Dillon, "You've got no guts." Sting turned to Hogan and said, "And you're a dead man." So what do you think of this turn of events between Sting and Hogan?
Yeah, this was like everything was perfect except they didn't stick the landing.
Yes.
Like, I think that Starrcade match is a signal. Like, it's the canary in the coal mine for a lot of problems that would crop up within WCW over the next, 4 years. And it's like you had this perfect solution. But, if you believe the reports from that time of what was going on backstage, it's that Hogan and Bischoff felt that Sting was not in proper in-ring shape, given that the man's been sitting for a year. he's been working out, obviously, but, there's a difference between being in shape and being in ring shape. And so they felt that they didn't just want to go through with a squash match. They wanted to make it a little bit more competitive, which doesn't make any sense because, obviously, like, first of all, the audacity of your man Terry Bollea, Andy Atherton, to question anybody's in-ring acumen. Sir, I'm going to need you to look in the mirror. Like, there's a way that you could, like, even if Sting, let's say, that they were right, and Sting was 75% of what he normally would be, there's still a way that you can put together a match. Like, the fans are so into it that all you have to do is give them a finish.
Yeah.
Give them a clean finish. Put Sting over strong, and then, he can get into shape over the next few weeks. But because they decided to go with this convoluted finish and mirror the Montreal Screwjob, it just didn't work for anybody. Like, Hogan didn't look stronger because of this. Sting looked weaker. Bret Hart looked like an idiot. And so it just didn't work. It left a sour taste in people's mouths. Like, even though Sting won, it was undercut because of the way that they had him win. So, like, yes, like, the angle gets an A+, like one of the best executed angles in the history of wrestling, but the match was just so disappointing.
Yeah. This kind of goes with what was Eric Bischoff and WCW's Achilles heel. So intent on putting the WWF, I believe still at the time, out of business, beating them in the ratings, giving away these matches on TV. They didn't stick to what made them successful. Yes, the shock value and all that stuff, but you had to go back and look. Vince wasn't giving away things on Raw. Yeah, they had Foley's world title on a taped episode. So be it. But Hogan Goldberg should never have been on a Nitro. There's lots of things that should never have been on a Nitro or not on a Thunder. But this goes into it. Did they need to mimic the Montreal Screwjob? No, they did not need to mimic the Montreal Screwjob. They need to stick to their own thing. The NWO was unique. It was their own thing. If they had just kept with that mentality, they may have survived quite a bit longer than they did.
Yep.
So Sting, his music had changed. He had kind of like that Crow Sting thing going on.
Yeah, like the orchestra piece almost.
Yeah. When did he start using Seek and Destroy by Metallica? Was it during this time or was it after?
After. Because, we're still in the period where, they had the creepy little kid reading the poem off the top.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And we got, he's bringing a live crow to the ring at times. He's still doing the gimmick where he's coming down from the rafters. This is like right in the middle of kind of that orchestral Sting introduction.
Okay. So you have a favorite match from this time period?
I mean, it's by default just because other than some of the stuff earlier that we talked about with him and Luger teaming up, Like the biggest match from this time period with the NWO is obviously that Starrcade 97 match. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, like they botched the finish because this needed to be like no more than 10 minutes. And that's including entrances. Like it needed to be Hogan coming out, Sting coming out, Michael Buffer picking up his paycheck. And then, you know, you can have Hulk get off a couple early shots and then Sting just runs through the guy.
Yep, that's what it should have been. And then, so in '98 starts. The NWO begins to splinter. Sting recaptures the WCW World Heavyweight Championship at February at Super Brawl 8 at the help of Savage, who was beginning to split from the NWO. Sting went on to successfully defend his title against the likes of Hall, Nash, and DDP. But also, Nash began to pull away from the Hogan-dominated NWO and help Savage beat Sting for the championship at Spring Stampede in April. Then Nash and Savage officially split from the original NWO in May, forming the face group, the NWO Wolfpack, while Hogan's heel faction became identified as NWO Hollywood. The two NWO factions vied for Sting's allegiance, with Sting's friends the Giant joining the Hollywood contingent and Luger joining the Wolfpack. Sting had seemed to have joined the Hollywood version when he appeared wearing a black and white NWO shirt, but soon tore the shirt off to reveal the red and black of the NWO Wolfpack. Sting began wearing red and black face paint and tights as a member of the Wolfpack. What did you think of this? Were you a fan of this?
Yeah, this is another misstep by WCW, and the fact that Sting should never be aligned with the NWO. Even if the Wolfpack had the better theme music, this shouldn't have been a thing. I think they ended up ultimately hurting Sting's credibility, and the red face paint just doesn't look as cool as the black and white face paint.
No, it just, yeah, it looks more cartoonish, you know.
Yeah.
It just didn't fit. To me, you know, now we'll talk about this when we get to TNA. I mean, he was a heel in TNA, but I was not a fan. Like I equate him to Ricky Steamboat. He should have been WCW's Ricky Steamboat. Never turned heel the whole time. He should have been a face the entire time. And even though the Wolfpack was a face, he was, you know, running with not the right crowd, so to speak. Like he should not have been friends with Nash and all that. Luger, like we said, Luger will turn on a dime. But Sting, yeah. Sting should have not. He should have never, you know, he's like one of those guys in college. We used to call them GDIs. You know, he's not a Greek organization. He's a goddamn independent. Steve should have stayed a goddamn independent.
Yeah, like it just didn't make any sense. And I think that maybe the only positive we got from Wolfpack Sting is that I think a lot of the character we see from Wolfpack Sting, he later brings in TNA, where it's a little bit more manic. It's a little bit more almost like Jim Carrey from The Mask.
Yeah.
I think this is where we get kind of like he said it before this point, but this is really where like it's showtime folk Sting kind of kicks in.
Yes. And then, so he goes on to win the tag titles with the Giant, when Hall turns on his teammate Nash, and then Sting and the Giant also split and the team was forced to vacate.
Yeah, this is another bad period for WCW where we start to get into the Nash versus Hall feud, where we get into Hall's alcoholism.
Yeah, this was not good, in my opinion. Sting then defeated the Giant at the Great American Bash in June to take control of the tag titles and chose Nash as his partner. Throughout the summer, Sting and fellow NWO Wolfpack members Nash, Luger, and Conan feuded with Hogan, NWO Hollywood. Sting also got involved in a feud with Bret Hart over their similar finishing holds, the Sharpshooter and the Scorpion Deathlock. Hart, this is up there with the, you know, who was the best rap master WCW feud, you know what I mean? Hart cost Sting and Nash the tag titles by interfering in a match with Hall and the Giant on the July 20th Nitro. Sting and Hart squared off at Halloween Havoc, where Hart, the United States champion, attacked Sting with a baseball bat, putting him out of action for several months. He then returned on March of 99, sporting the black and white Crow-inspired attire. He had debuted in 96 and began to participate in more mic work. By this time, the NWO storyline had faded, and Sting was not aligned with any of his factions. Sting then competed in the main event of April's Spring Stampede, a Four Corners match for the World Heavyweight Championship against Hogan, DDP, and champion Flair. Savage Stern as special guest referee, delivering a diving elbow drop to help DDP win the match and the title. So what do you think of this? So, you know, the Wolfpack thing ends for him and he comes back. What do you think of his return?
I thought that, you know, it was kind of a reset button. Like, they hit the reset button on Sting. They're like, yeah, this Wolfpack thing isn't working. Let's kind of go back to what we know. If I'm recalling, I think Sting, like, yeah, he's got the black and white, but he's also shortened his hair a little bit. Like, it's still long, but it's not long and scraggly like it was with Wolfpack Sting.
Yes, it was a little out of control there.
He's almost, like, I think at this point, Sting's almost got, like, the beginnings of, because I know particularly in like 99 and into 2000, he was rocking like a Karen bob. Like his hair looked like Bailey's hair right now. Like he had like a little bob that worked for him as much as I guess it was going to work. And if you looked at his tights, like they almost had like little spats on the feet now.
Yes.
Which weren't there before, so he was like a little Puss in Boots, kind of like a little white spat on the bottom of his tights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was not a fan of this. Really, this look, nah, wasn't working for me.
Like I said, the only positive was it wasn't Wolfpack's thing. Like, at least we were getting somewhat closer to normal.
Yes. So,
like Wolfpack's thing to bring it home for the listeners. Mm-hmm. Wolfpack's thing is like being under quarantine, and 99's thing is like you can go to the store, but you have to wear a mask. Like you're doing normal things, but it just isn't quite right yet. That's what 99's thing was.
Do you think Wolfpack's thing had a signature feud or a best match? In your opinion?
It probably would have been with the Giant, because I do remember a couple of the matches, because Sting, even if the character, like the gimmick wasn't working, like Sting always worked with big guys. Because mm-hmm. he was quick enough to bump around for him, but he was also big enough that he could do like power moves and slamming the Giant and stuff like that. So I thought him and the Giant had some pretty good chemistry. In terms of any signature matches, like none that come to mind. Like those Giant matches were fine, but we're not where we were in the late 80s where he was just putting out classic match after classic match.
Yeah. There's nothing memorable like that stands out. Like this is head and shoulders above everything else. And then
like this is where we see them starting to not take care of Sting again. Like, this is supposed to be a top guy, and, you know, maybe a lot of that is due to the Hogan influence or the Nash and Hall influence, but they did not treat Sting like the star he is. Even if the fans are still into Sting, the company isn't treating him like a top guy, and so the storylines don't reflect that he's a top guy.
Okay. I see that. So, and then April 26th of 99, Sting defeated Page on Edition Nitro to win the Heavyweight Championship for the fifth time. Later that night, Sting defended the title in a four-way match between DDP, Goldberg, and a returning Nash. Kevin Nash, DDP, pinned Nash, allowing DDP to win the title without directly beating Sting. Sting's 90-minute title reign was only the second shortest WCW World Heavyweight Championship reign in WCW history. Sting then lost to Rick Steiner in a False Count Anywhere match at the Great American Bash after he was attacked by Steiner's three pet dogs backstage. Steiner forced the referee to prematurely declare himself the victor, claiming his dogs had pinned Sting for him. No wonder why they went out of business.
Yeah, this is bad because we haven't even gotten to 2000 yet. Like this is where the slide begins. When I think Sting, you can almost use Sting as a barometer for the company as a whole, Andy.
Yes,
like wherever Sting is on the card at a particular time, that's how good the company's doing. Mm-hmm. Sting is this up and coming baby face, and he crowds, and it feels like, you know, Crockett / NWA is an upcoming promotion that can rival the WWF if their card's right. And then when we get to the NWO, like Sting is obviously one of your biggest stars, and the company as a whole feels like it's clicking on all cylinders. But after Starrcade 97, he's diminished and the company's diminished.
Yes, exactly. Great point and great analogy. And then over the next several months, Sting feud with Goldberg, Rick Steiner, Sid Vicious, Randy Savage. He teamed with WCW World Heavyweight Champion Kevin Nash at Bash at the Beach in July to take on Vicious and Savage of Team Madness. Savage pinned Nash to win a world title result. Then Hulk Hogan returns from injury on July 12th as a babyface to win the World Heavyweight Championship. Sting defeated Flair on the July 19th edition of Nitro to become the on-screen president of WCW. Later that night, Nash turned heel by attacking Hogan during a title defense against Vicious. Sting remained president for just 1 week and used his power to book the main event, pinning Hogan and himself against Nash and Vicious. Sting then vacated the presidency the following week only because he wanted Flair out of the position rather than wanting power for himself. Along with Goldberg, Sting and Hogan feud with Nash, Vicious, and Rick Steiner for the next month.
I will say, Andy.
Yes.
As forgettable as the Steve Borden presidency was, I'd rather have that presidency right now in America, because Sting might only be around for 2 weeks in the White House, but he'll clean stuff up in those 2 weeks.
Yeah, he'll get shit done. You know, like, I don't necessarily want to be president, but I just don't want him to be president. And
exactly.
That's why I'm here. Sting then began to question Hogan's trustworthiness and credibility in the weeks leading up to Fall Brawl. At the September pay-per-view, Luger brought a baseball bat to ring, and Sting used it to beat Hogan for the sixth and final WCW Heavyweight Championship, turning heel for the first time in WCW. Sting's heel turn and subsequent attitude change did not resonate with the WCW fans, no shit, and they still cheered Sting, despite the fact he was supposed to be a villain, reminiscent of the Road Warriors heel turn back in 1988.
Well, that's the thing. He's supposed to be a heel, but he's beating up a person that nobody likes. So it's like, yeah, you're like, no, you're right, Sting. We appreciate this gesture that you're doing right now.
Yeah, it's, you know, you would have to beat up somebody who's even more of a babyface than you are.
Exactly.
And in WCW, I don't think there was such a thing. You know, his heel, his being a heel is like Goldberg being a heel. You know, it just didn't work.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And then at Halloween Havoc, Sting retained the title against Hogan after Hogan entered the ring in street clothes and laid down for Sting to pin him. After the match, Sting sounded his disdain for the result and issued an open challenge for later that night. That night, Sting lost an unsanctioned match to Goldberg, who accepted the open challenge and then attacked referee Charles Robinson. Sting was stripped of the title next night for attacking the official. Sting then entered the 32-man tournament that was set up to award the vacant WCW World Heavyweight Championship. Sting defeated Brian Knobs, Meng, and Luger to reach the semifinals to be held at WCW Mayhem. At the November event, Sting lost to Bret Hart, the eventual winner of the tournament.
Let's go back. And name those luminaries that Sting was in there with.
Brian Knobs, Meng, and Lex Luger.
Like, outside of Jennifer Smith, I don't know anybody who's excited to see Brian Knobs in this tournament.
Well, Knobs has a special place in the bowels of Place to Meet Asian members. You know, and Meng, you know, I love the great Haku, but...
Yeah.
And then Luger...
By this point, Meng was just kind of there.
Yeah. He just, you know, that's a guy that can go, you know, and it's believable that he could kill anybody. So let's put him in the ring, you know. And then after the match, Sting shook hands with Hart as a sign of respect, turning face again. Sting then sought revenge against Luger the next month at Starrcade. Sting won by disqualification when Luger and Miss Elizabeth assaulted Sting with a steel chair and a baseball bat, putting Sting out of action for some time. Sting ended his feud with Luger by defeating him in a lumberjack with cast match at Uncensored the following March. So, this whole time period, you know, which includes Sting and his world title reign, some of these ridiculous matches, his ill-fated heel turn.
Getting attacked by dogs.
Was there a signature feud here that you can point to?
I mean, the feud that they wanted to be the signature feud was with Luger.
Yeah.
That's who the company wanted to buy as a signature feud, but it didn't work because the connection between Sting and Luger, while it's always there, it certainly wasn't as present as it was in years prior. Mm-hmm. Like, if they wanted to do Sting and Luger, the time to do it would have been when he returned from the rafters.
Yeah.
Because Lex was the one that doubted him in the first place, and you could have told that story. But by this point, Lex Luger is not really that connected with Sting. And then the second point, Andy, is Luger's a much far more diminished worker.
Yes.
Than he was even 2 years prior to this. Like, he's not as mobile. He's a little too bulky. You know, he's not even really a great promo at this point. So it's like Sting is having to do the heavy lifting in this match, and it's just not appealing.
No, not at all. You know, it's trying to do something when it's been done already and it's being done, you know, years too late. What about his signature? Who is his signature feud with, you think? I mean, his signature match. I'm sorry. I already asked a feud. It's late.
Signature match, it... like, again, you're dealing with slim pickings right here. but I guess, like, maybe the heart match.
Yeah.
Probably. Maybe the heart match, because that was always, even though they never got the story right between Sting and Bret Hart, I think just seeing the two of them in a ring was cool, but you've got a Sting character who's not what it should be, and you've also got Bret Hart, who was misused almost from day one in WCW.
Yes, he was, you know, on some of my Great Debate Wrestling shows, we probably should talk about this, you know, in reverse. We talked about guys that were misused or not used right in WWE, but we should talk about WCW. Like, the whole Bret Hart thing is up there with the Warrior and probably a few others to think of, like, where it just didn't work. You know, it just, they just didn't know what to do. There were some...
Like, how do you take a gift like Bret Hart signing with your company after the screw job and just waste it? You know, it'd be like, Andy, if I got you a brand new, I'm trying to think of what would be the hot item right now. What's that new hotness on the street for the kids? It'd be like if I got you a Xbox, X, the new Xbox coming out. If I got you that, Andy, spent my hard-earned money and gave you this wonderful gift, and instead of plugging it up and playing it and enjoying it with your family, I come over to your house, Andy, and I see you using this wonderful Xbox as a coaster, as a hat rack, as a paperweight. And it's like, what are you doing? You're wasting this gift. And I think that's what they did with Bret. Like, they never figured out how to use Bret Hart the right way when it should have been so easy. Like, bring him in as one of the biggest baby faces in your company. Have him fight against the NWO if you want, but keep this man away from any storyline that even references the screw job. Like, that's not what we're doing with this guy.
Yeah, that was just...
Like, because that makes it seem like he's only here because he has to be. Like, you need to make it seem like everybody wants to be here. Like, this is the place to be if you want real competition. And that's why Bret came here. Not Bret came here because he got into an argument with his old boss.
Yeah. After he had just signed, like, this huge, like, what was it, like, 10-15 year deal or something like that? Oh, yeah. That was such a time when WCW just, like I said, their focus was not right. They just were intent on the wrong things. And that's what screwed him in the end. Speaking of the end, though, let's go through 2000 to 2002 with WCW officials Vince Russo, let me tell you, bro, and Eric Bischoff, in an attempt to save the fading company, rebooted all their storylines on April 10th, declared all the titles vacant. As Spring Stampede the following week, Sting advanced to the finals in the United States Championship Tournament, defeating Booker T and Vampiro in the first two rounds. Vampiro cost Sting the championship in the finals against Scott Steiner, leading into an intense feud between Sting and Vampiro. Sting pinned Vampiro at Slamboree in May, and then Vampiro beat Sting in a Human Torch match at the Great American Bash the next month. For the climax of the match, Sting, Steve Borden, switched with a stuntman who was set on fire and thrown off the top of the frame of the stage's entrance video screen. I try to keep a straight face. At Bash at the Beach, he returned wearing another Sting mask as a man wearing cloaks, and Sting mask carried him in a casket, and he then attacked Vampiro. Sting then went on to feud Jeff Jarrett and then Scott Steiner. Steiner attacked and injured Sting in November 2000. Sting stayed off WCW programming until the final episode of Nitro on March 26. WCW had been purchased by the World Wrestling Federation, and the final match in WCW history pitted Sting against his longtime rival Ric Flair. The two had also competed on the very first edition of Nitro on September 4th, 1995. Sting defeated Flair and the two embraced at the end of the contest. After the WWF did not buy out Sting's contract with AOL Time Warner, he rejected a buyout offer of 50 cents in the dollar from AOL Time Warner, instead waiting until his contract expired in March of 2002. He announced a short-lived retirement in February of that year. He then entered into contract negotiations with WWF and ultimately did not join a promotion. So, here we are at the end of WCW. What do you think of his feud with Vampiro?
So much wasted potential. Because at that point, Vampiro was actually a guy that you could have done something with, mm-hmm. with Sting, where, you know, Sting is the icon that Vampiro has to take down if he wants to get to where he needs to be. You know, Vampiro is outside. He wants to be in the room where it happens, Andy. And to do that, he's got to take out Sting. And so there was a story to be told. And I guess by definition, technically, they told a story. Yeah. But it's not one that anybody wanted to listen to.
No, not at all. No, it was ridiculous upon ridiculous. You know, thought the giant falling off the roof was one thing.
Did we mention the change in theme music?
No, we did not.
By this point.
No.
Yeah, because we've gone from the orchestral Sting, then we went, obviously, to the Wolfpack music during the Wolfpack years. And then when Sting comes back, we've got Seek and Destroy. Because Time Warner's got to, I think Time Warner's got to sell records. I guess that's why he's got this new theme music.
Are they just like spending money, like Voodoo Child and what have you?
Like Voodoo Child, Goldberg, because I think Goldberg at this time had gone from his cool orchestral theme to the Megadeth song "Crush 'Em."
Wow, I forgot about that. Wow.
Yeah, because it was for Universal Soldier. Universal Soldiers 2, whichever it was, that he was in with Van Damme. And Crush 'Em was used to promote that movie, and also it was Goldberg's new theme song. And Eric Bischoff, being Eric Bischoff, spent money to have a Megadeth concert on Nitro that nobody cared about.
That sounds like Eric Bischoff, all right.
It was so sad, because I don't even like Megadeth like that, but just the fact that these guys were playing hard and nobody was reacting, it felt like, for anybody that was on Twitter this past week or the weekend of 4th of July, and saw the White House 4th of July celebration, where you had my guy in the Navy who was out here singing Bruno Mars' Uptown Funk to a crowd of about 20 people. And just wasn't getting any reaction from the crowd. That's how Megadeth looked when they were playing "Crush 'Em" for these WCW fans.
Yeah, it was. I have to go back and revisit. I actually just started a watch. I'm starting at the first episode of Raw. I'm going to go all the way through both WWF and WCW once Nitro hits up.
I don't know if those old. They're probably not. Going to say I don't know if those old performances are on there.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I'll probably cut them out for. Money reasons and licensing.
Yeah, if they can't play Ernest the Cat Miller's real theme music, there's no way they're paying Metallica.
That's true, especially Lars, who was up against Napster.
Yep.
So, what did you think though of the end of WCW? What were your feelings watching the final episode of Nitro?
It was sad because I think that obviously. By this point in 2000, wrestling fans were a bit more internet savvy, Andy.
Yes.
And so, we're starting to hear rumors behind the scenes. Whether you're talking about, reading the Observer or going in the chat rooms and talking with other fans, So we knew that Eric Bischoff was trying to come back and buy WCW with Fusion Media.
With Jason Hervey.
And so, yeah, with Jason Hervey. And so we thought that there was hope here, that WCW was going to, you know, take a couple months off, go black, as they say, and then come back. But I guess the old adage was true, Andy. Once you go black, you never come back, because WCW never came back, and they were bought for, you know, you talk about Sting's contract, you know, Sting not wanting to sign with the WWF for 50 cents on the dollar. Vince came in and buys WCW for pennies on the dollar. It's crazy how little he paid for this entire company.
Yes, a company that almost put him out of business.
Yeah.
It's insane. I mean, I would love two of them to continue, but the product just was not good at all. It hadn't been good for a long time. I did love, though, how they were able to bookend Nitro by letting Sting and Flair have the last match on Nitro after they had the first match.
And it's like, again, like, it's not a great match, but it's Sting and Flair, so it's good. And, like, Flair's not even in shape. They just flew him out for this, so he's wearing his T-shirt. And, you know, Sting is not in prime Sting shape. So, you know, they're just kind of going through an abbreviated version of the greatest hits, because I think they only gave him, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But you get some great little moments where I think there's a point where, you know, Sting goes for something and Flair knows what Sting's going for, because they've done this match a million times, and he kind of stops, and then they just kind of have this genuine moment where they break character and just smile at each other. Yeah. And so, like, I really like this is probably my favorite match that Sting has during this time period, just because of the real emotion behind it, because you can tell, like, these are two guys that don't know if they're going to wrestle again, and in Sting's case, like, he doesn't know what is next. Like, the only thing that's for sure is nothing's for sure. So I really kind of liked that this was the final match on Nitro, and I wish they had given him time to, like, let the moment soak in and give the fans a nice moment to leave with. But, you know, Vince being Vince, had to get in his angle with his son to close the show. Yeah. So we couldn't give Sting and Flair time to kind of have their moment.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, yeah, like, but it's no great match by any stretch, but as a wrestling fan, knowing what this company meant to these two men, especially Sting, that they got to wrestle the last match in the history of the company on the last episode of their signature show, you know, you could definitely, yeah, I think I teared up that night watching it live, because it was end of an era.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I'm so glad they gave Sting the victory, because that's, like, if you're telling the story of the end of WCW, yes, obviously Ric Flair in terms of wrestling history is the bigger name, is the bigger star, is probably the more important historical figure. Mm-hmm. But Sting means so much more to that company. And so, you know, you have Flair once again for the last time in WCW putting Sting over. And so I think that, like, having Sting win the final match in WCW history, despite how terrible the last couple of years had been for him, I thought that was a nice move.
Yes, it was. You know, it really is a shame that, you know, yeah, they were all these high contracts, and you can't blame these guys from a business standpoint. You can't blame Sting, Goldberg, you know, Nash, Hogan, Hall, all these guys for not, you know, taking buyouts. The only one doing it was DDP. And, you know, going over
and that's probably what, like, I think that's probably the reason Sting decided not to. One of the big reasons is when you look back and see how DDP is treated early on.
Yes.
When you see how, you know, Booker T to some extent is treated early on, like, so many of the WCW guys didn't get a fair shake when they first came in. So Sting's like, you know, Vince is telling me I'll be all right, but I don't have any proof by what I'm seeing on TV to go by.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but that invasion angle could have been something else. I mean, yes, Vince would have probably put the guys down before, you know, he let them get any shine, but that could have been something. You don't have an invasion angle led by Sean Stasiak and Sean O'Hare, you know, Mark Jindrak. You are no Sting, D. Hall, and Nash.
Yeah. Like, honestly, like, the only good WCW guys, that, and I don't mean to say that there weren't people that worked hard, but in terms of, like, stars and people that could go, you know, they wasted DDP with the Undertaker angle. Mm-hmm. Then after that, like, Booker and Lance Storm are really the only good guys you got out of this whole bunch.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there were guys with potential that they just totally did nothing with and made look like fools, basically. You know?
And that's like still one of the biggest wasted opportunities to this day.
Yes, in history of
wrestling. And the fact is, they didn't have to rush. Like, I get, the, you know, when people talk about, like, you know, what did you want Vince to do? You know, everybody had these guaranteed contracts. Well, everybody ended up in the WWE eventually anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So all he had to do was, like, wait a year. Like, you could sprinkle things in here and there. Like, you know, again, going back to Sting versus the NWO. They told that story over a year and let it cook and let it marinate. That's what Vince could have did with the Invasion. And, you know, by the time the year is up, then you can come in with Bischoff, Hall, and Nash and Sting, if Sting decides to sign, and Flair and all these big guys. And now we've got something here.
Yeah, they just, you know, Vince just wanted to keep, you know, peeing on the grave of WCW, basically. He just wanted to just put that needle in the ground. He's like, I don't care who you are. If you came from WCW, I'm putting you down. And, yeah, it was a big time-wasted opportunity. So after it closes up shop in 2002, after a year and a half of hiatus, Steve Borden, a.k.a. Sting, toured Europe with the World Wrestling All-Stars, the WWA promotion, throughout November and December. His first match in the WWA took place on November 28th. 2002 in Dublin, Ireland, when he reunited with Lex Luger to defeat Buff Bagwell and Malice at the Retribution on December 6th, 2002 at Glasgow, Scotland, United Kingdom. Sting lost to Luger in a bout for the vacant WWA World Heavyweight Championship. Sting then defeated Luger to claim it in Zurich, Switzerland on December 13th. Sting embarked on a second tour with the WWA in May of 2003, successfully defending his championship against Rick Steiner, Shane Douglas, and Disco Inferno. The WWE held its final show, The Reckoning, on May 25th in Auckland, New Zealand, where the NWA World Heavyweight Champion Jeff Jarrett defeated Sting for the WWA World Heavyweight Championship, unifying the two championships. Now, did you watch any of this? Was this... Because I don't even remember this.
Yeah, like, I've seen some of this stuff in hindsight, but yeah, it wasn't something I watched at the time. And this is a weird period where you've got all these strange star-studded tours overseas, because you got a lot of talent that didn't sign with the WWE immediately. So you've got Jeff Jarrett and Dennis Rodman heading a tour in Australia, or you've got this WWA thing. And so, yeah, I remember a lot of this stuff, because this was also the time where Jerry Lawler was estranged from the WWF.
Yes.
So, like, you would actually have Jerry Lawler calling a bunch of these shows. So it was a weird time period. But, yeah, I didn't watch it at the time. I think at this time I was still watching WWE just because the Invasion, like, they hadn't completely flamed out just quite yet, but I was certainly looking for an alternative, and what do you know? Good old Double J was there to save the wrestling world, Andy Atherton.
Thank God for that. And then, so then we talk about total nonstop action. He's made sporadic appearances in 2003 and 2004. He signed a contract committing to 4 appearances in the beginning. He debuted on June 18th on the one-year anniversary show, teaming with Jeff Jarrett to defeat AJ Styles and Six-Pac. Following this, he engaged in a comprehensive series of sit-down interviews with Mike Tenay, discussing his career and faith. He then returned on November 5th, 2003, defeating Jarrett by disqualification in a match for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. On November 12th, Sting teamed with AJ Styles to defeat Jarrett and Luger. He made his final appearance of 2003 on December 17th, defeating Jarrett in a non-title match. In March 2004, Borden was interviewed once again for Sting Moment of Truth. And on March 31st, he returned to company for one night only and a special guest enforcer for the main event four-way match between Abyss, AJ Styles, Raven, and Ron Killings, in which Raven had won. And then at Turning Point in December 11th of 2005... Jeff Jarrett stood in the ring celebrating his victory. The lights in the arena went out, and images of a scorpion, a.k.a. Sting's symbol, appeared on the arena screen, along with the date January 15, 2006. Spotlights then illuminated the ring, revealing a chair bearing Sting's signature trench coat, boots, and a black baseball bat in the center. His return to TNA was officially announced 1 minute after midnight on January 1st, 2006.
Was this around the time where The Undertaker was doing a similar thing?
Yeah, I believe so. I think there were parallels going on.
Yeah, because there was some people that thought that The Undertaker's video messages were actually Sting at the time.
That's right. Oh, God. And on January 15th, at Final Resolution, Sting and Christian Cage defeat NWA World Heavyweight Champion Jeff Jarrett and Monty Brown in a tag match after Sting pinned Jarrett on the episode on January 28th, 2006. On Impact, Sting made his Spike TV debut and first appearance on national television in almost 5 years, announcing his return. So then, what do you think of his showing up in TNA to begin with?
I think it was a big deal. Like, it was something that gave a bit of legitimacy to the promotion. Like, even if his last few years in WCW weren't the best, he was still by far the biggest free agent that was out there.
Yes.
He's somebody like, even up until his last match in TNA, the question was always, is Sting going to sign with WWE? Is Sting going to go to the WWE? And as we would see after he left TNA, like, that always opened. Like, Vince always looked at Sting as the one that got away, like the Moby Dick to Vince McMahon's Captain Ahab.
Yes.
The great white whale out there in the ocean that Vince could never quite catch. So the fact that Sting attached his name and his star power to TNA was a big deal, and I think gave them a lot of interest from fans that had maybe checked out after WCW folded.
Mm-hmm. So, with Sting gone, the storyline continued, with Jarrett and Eric Young worrying that Sting had not actually retired, sending Alex Shelley to California to videotape Sting at home. Sting discovered Shelley filming and walked up to his car, said that he was going to show up at Destination X and confront Jeff Jarrett and Steve Borden. Clad in street clothes and without face paint, he returned on March 12th, Destination X, saving Christian Cage and Rhino as they were attacked by Jarrett's army. He placed Jarrett in the Scorpion Deathlock, but was attacked by debuting Scott Steiner. This led to a lethal lockdown match between Sting, AJ Styles, Ron Killings, and Rhino against Jarrett's army. On April 23rd at lockdown, Sting's team won the match. Following lockdown, he proceeded to seek out partners to help defeat Jeff Jarrett and Scott Steiner for good. Oh my God. After bringing out Lex Luger and Buff Bagwell, Rick Steiner as options. Wow, that's really the bottom of the barrel. He settled on Samoa Joe. On May 14th, at Sacrifice, Sting and Joe defeated Jarrett and Steiner after Joe pinned Jarrett with a muscle buster. Still having proven unsuccessful at putting Jarrett away, Sting defeated Scott Steiner by disqualification and earned a spot in the King of the Mountain match at Slammiversary on June 18th. Due to a confrontation with Christian Cage during the match, Sting was distracted, which allowed crooked referee Earl Hebner to knock over the ladder. Both were sending both men to the floor, allowed Jarrett to pick up the victory. Wow. You know, it sounds a lot like with WCW. This is all stuff that would have been great, like, with guys 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
You know.
And we've already got to throw a crooked referee in there somewhere.
Yeah. Crooked referee, there's always, you know, breaking out. It's like Sting can't quit Luger. Like, I can't quit you. You know, on July 15th, at Victory Road, Sting wins a fatal four-way match to win a title shot for Jarrett's NWA World Heavyweight Championship.
Yeah, I think something that's important to mention here, Andy, mm-hmm. is Sting, like, the year or so, I guess, of not being a full-time wrestler, mm-hmm. actually was beneficial because he comes back here in much better shape
yeah.
than he was when he left WCW. It feels like maybe that time away has given him a bit of a refresher, and he feels more invested in wrestling than he has in years.
Yeah, I think he probably always had wanted to stick it to WWE, so he's coming with this like kind of smaller upstart where he's treated like a legend, basically.
Yeah.
And, he received a title shot at Hard Justice on August 13th, but failed to capture the title after Christian Cage turned heel and hit Sting with Jarrett's guitar. He would have another match at Bound for Glory where he put his career on the line. He went on to claim his second NWA World Heavyweight title while he made Jarrett submit. and marking his first championship that he won since 99. With that, he became the oldest NWA heavyweight champion in the TNA era. This will also go on to make Sting the longest superstar to recapture a second NWA title between 1990 and 2006. Sting lost the title to Abyss on November 19th at Genesis by disqualification after pushing aside the referee and pushing Abyss into a stack of tables covered in barbed wire. In the weeks following Genesis, Sting feud with Abyss continued, and Christian Cage was involved, following the three of them in a three-way match for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship at a turning point where Abyss retained the title. Now, were you watching TNA at this time, or had you not started watching it?
Yeah, this was like peak TNA, because I think, you know, a lot of people were kind of tuning in now, and you mentioned Christian Cage. Like, Christian jumping to TNA was another big deal, because he was really one of the first WWE guys of some stature that made that transition.
He's like your Chris Jericho is now of AEW.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we'll get to an even bigger signing coming up here pretty quickly, Andy, with Kurt Angle joining the company. Mm-hmm. And I think like TNA certainly had some momentum at this time. I was definitely watching, like, this is when they finally found their long-term TV home until Vince Russo messes it up a couple years down the road with Spike TV. And you're getting some really good TV at this time. Sure, there's some stupid angles here and there, but that's par for the course with wrestling. Like, you can't erase all of the stupidity from the sport. But yeah, this is a really good time for TNA.
Yes, and 2007 came along. Sting continues feud with Abyss, where a trial trying to recapture the World Heavyweight Championship, facing him at Final Resolution against All Odds and Destination X in a last rights match, but never was able to claim the title. Also, they were placed on different teams at Lethal Lockdown match. Sting, with the help of Jeff Jarrett, pinned Abyss to win the match for his team and end their bitter rivalry. I sacrificed a match between Sting, Kurt Angle, and the NWA World Heavyweight Champion Christian Cage was booked the day of the pay-per-view. The National Wrestling Alliance, the owners of the World Heavyweight title and the Tag Team Championship, stripped Cage of the title and Team 3D of their tag team titles. The NWA Executive Director, Robert K. Trowbridge, stated the reason was that Cage refused to defend the NWA title at NWA live events. At the event, Cage, still holding the physical NWA championship belt, defended what was billed as the World Heavyweight Championship against Sting and Angle. Angle was the victor of the contest by making Sting submit and was announced a new TNA World Heavyweight Champion. The impact following the event, the title was labeled the TNA World Heavyweight Championship, but the title was vacated. A tournament was then held for the title, which culminated in a King of the Mountain match at Slammiversary. Sting lost his qualifying match with Samoa Joe after Christopher Daniels interfered. Sting then instead faced Daniels on June 17th at Slammiversary, which he ultimately won. So now we have Sting with a lot of fresh feuds here. What do you think of his matches with Abyss and Christian and Christopher Daniels?
Sting had good chemistry with somebody like a Christian. I think that the Abyss feud was interesting because Sting, as we mentioned, Andy, always kind of meshes and gels well with these bigger guys. Mm-hmm. And Abyss is a big guy, but he's not giant big. He's not Vader big, but he's still a pretty big dude. Mm-hmm. And so I think their matches weren't as good as some of those classic feuds that Sting had, but I think they really helped Abyss. And that might be one of the bigger benefits to Sting for TNA at this time, besides the star power and the name value, is that from all reports, like, this is Sting in locker room leader mode, where he's here to help guys like AJ. Mm-hmm. He's here to help young guys, quote unquote, like Chris Daniels. Cause even then I think Chris Daniels was still like 40 years old at the time. The man ages, but Chris Daniels has always looked like he's in his mid-30s to me, like mid-30s to early 40s, no matter how old he is. But I think Sting just being in that locker room was a big help because you could see guys stepping their game up because this is somebody who they probably grew up watching.
Yeah. Yeah, they're probably like, oh, I get to be in the ring with Sting. I gotta make sure I perform. After his feud with Daniel, Sting began teaming with his former enemy Abyss, who had recently turned face. Together, they went on to defeat AJ Styles and Tomko at Victory Road. While trying to help Abyss win a match against AJ Styles, Sting and Abyss were attacked by Christian's coalition. Abyss was pulled under the ring, and Sting was slammed into broken glass by Tomko before Abyss emerged, bleeding badly, and was slammed into the broken glass as well as with thumbtacks. The following week, Sting and Abyss got revenge, defeating Christian Cage and AJ Styles in a ladder match, in the process earning a contract that would allow them to pick the type of match between Abyss and Christian at Hard Justice. Sting's team won in a Doomsday Chamber of Blood match, with Abyss pinning AJ Styles to become the 1-1 contender for the World Heavyweight Championship. After that, Sting started a feud with TNA World Champion Kurt Angle. Oh, God, imagine a feud between those two guys in their primes. That would have been something. First, Sting defeated AJ Styles, Christian Cage, and Samoa Joe in a 4-way match to become the co-holder of the World Tag Team Champions with Angle, but lost it 30 days later against Adam Pac-Man Jones and Ron Killian at No Surrender.
Yes, the Pac-Man Jones era in TNA wrestling.
Yes, pretty infamous. Sting would then face Angle for the world title at Bound for Glory, where Sting won his first TNA World Heavyweight Championship. However, he lost title back to Angle 2 days later on Impact after Kevin Nash interfered on Angle's behalf. Sting would face Angle and Nash at Genesis, with the debuting Booker T as his mystery partner. In the match, whoever scored the pinfall would win the TNA World Heavyweight Championship, which Angle won after pinning Sting, same thing. This would be the final TNA appearance of Sting in 2007. He would take some time off to be his family. He then returned officially March 27th at Lockdown. He teamed with Team Cage, Christian Cage, Kevin Nash, Rhino, and Matt Morgan, and defeated Team Tomko, AJ Styles, James Storm, and Team 3D. After the tag titles were vacated, Jim Cornette held the Deuces Wild Tag Team Tournament to determine new champs. Four teams were already in the Sacrifice Finals, while Cornette named eight wrestlers the Egotistical Eight. Sting's partner was James Storm, and on May 11th, Sacrifice, they came up short due to their inability to get along, and towards the end, Sting attacked Storm and walked out. Sting was not seen after, except for an interview when he talked about his career and eventual retirement. And then on July 13th at Victory Road, Booker T faced Samoa Joe for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. During the match, Sting tried to talk sense into Joe as he was brutally beating Booker T, but it was potentially heading towards a disqualification. Joe rebuked him, and Sting struck him with his trademark black bat. Over the coming weeks, the feud between Joe and Booker intensified, with episodes ending with Booker T or Charmel striking Samoa Joe with Sting's trademark back as Impact went off the air, leading to question whether or not Sting had turned on Samoa Joe and become a heel. Although he received face reactions from the fans, Sting sided with Booker T. And on August 10th at Hard Justice, Sting attacked AJ Styles after he and Kurt Angle wrestled in a Last Man Standing match. So what do you think of this whole time with his matches with Kurt, his matches with Joe and the like? Where was he at?
Yeah, I think, you talk about Sting and Kurt and how great it would have been to see them both in their primes. Like, that's obviously a dream match, but even here, I feel like Sting is able to hang with Kurt. Kurt, elevates Sting a bit. Kurt is somebody that Sting has always spoken highly of. Kurt is somebody that Sting has often said is the best professional wrestler ever, because he's like the only one of us that could legitimately go out there and do what we pretend to do. Basically is what Sting has said in the past. And then we get to teaming up with Booker T, which is great because it's leading to the formation of the Main Event Mafia, which is a stable that I don't think gets a lot of credit, but it was a really interesting way of presenting these legends as heels, but without making them, outright dastardly and hateable. When you got Sting and Angle and Booker and Kevin Nash joining forces to form this stable, they were the bad guys, quote unquote, but the fans still enjoyed them.
Now, do you think this, or what was it, the New Blood versus the Millionaires Club? Which one do you think this was?
Yeah.
This was done the same thing, but done better.
This was the better version of New Bloods versus Millionaires.
Yeah, from the little that I've seen of this, I thought the Main Event Mafia, awesome name first of all, was a great.
It's an awesome name. Like, they've got this awesome knockoff Godfather music.
Yes,
theme.
I remember that. And then, and they would come out in suits.
Like, yeah, they all come out in suits. So, like, just from an aesthetic standpoint, I think the Main Event Mafia comes across better than the, you know, the Millionaire's Club.
Yeah, it was basically just the haves and the haves not over in WWE. Yeah. This was like, yeah, you have your front line, which is your Samoa Joes, your AJs, and against the Main Event Mafia, which made a lot of sense. These were guys that made their names elsewhere against these guys who are making their name here, who are guys from the Indies and what have you.
They kept the groups kind of small as opposed to the Millionaires Club and the New Bloods, which basically took up half the roster.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't get ridiculous with factions. You know, the NWO got too big. The LWO, don't even get me started on that. let's put all of our luchadors in one faction so they don't wrestle each other. Let's just do that, okay? Because that's a great idea. Anyway, Sting... let's see, what's called? The frontline Sting defend the title against AJ Styles at Turning Point and Rhino at Genesis. Sting then also feud with the leader of the Main Event Mafia, Kurt Angle, at Against All Odds. He defended the title against Angle, Brother Ray, and Brother Devon against Angle in a singles match at Destination X. At Lockdown, Sting lost the title to Mick Foley inside the Six Sides of Steel, ended his 189-day reign. On May 24th, the Sacrifice, Sting defeated Kurt Angle to become the new godfather of the Main Event Mafia. On June 21st, the Slammiversary, Sting defeated Matt Morgan in a singles match, thus preventing Morgan from joining the Main Event Mafia. The following episode, Sting's fellow Main Event Mafia members attacked him, removing him from the group, and Kurt Angle reclaimed his role as the godfather. You can't make this show. Well, you can, but the following week, Sting took revenge upon the Mafia when he attacked every member of the group and stole Angle's World Heavyweight Championship belt, becoming full-fledged face as a result. On July 19th at Victory Road, Sting was defeated by new Main Event Mafia member Samoa Joe in a singles match after the debuting Taz interfered on Joe's behalf. At Hard Justice, Sting unsuccessfully challenged Angle for the World Heavyweight Championship in a triple threat match, which also included Matt Morgan. And Sting lost a five-way match to the TNA for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship that also included AJ Styles, Hernandez, Kurt Angle, and Matt Morgan. Instead of pinning Angle, he opted to attack Morgan, which allowed Styles to pin Angle and become the new champion. As a token of gratitude, Styles offered to give him a title shot at the following month's pay-per-view Bound for Glory, a match billed possibly as being Sting's retirement match. At the match, Styles defeated Sting to retain the title, ending Sting's undefeated streak at Bound for Glory. After that, he announced whether he did not know whether he was going to continue his career or not, saying that the way you fans are reacting right now makes me want to stay forever. At the end of the year, the match was voted the match of the year by the fans of TNA. So, during this period, you know, he's wrestling AJ, he's wrestling Matt Morgan. What do you think of this time as his time in the Main Event Mafia comes to an end?
I really enjoyed it. Again, like, I think the Main Event Mafia, you know, is just a really smart way to position these legends. So that way, you know, you can put them in tag matches, you can have multiple man matches where they're not overextended, where we get Sting, we get Angle, we get Booker, we get Nash, we get Scott Steiner, and they're not overextended. I think that it's probably an underrated angle for its time. You know, when you look back at the history of TNA, like, obviously there's a lot of garbage, and, you know, me, Scott, and Steve have talked about this starting from show one with TNA and going back with our weekly, our monthly TNA rewatches. Like, there's a lot of bad in TNA, but I think that the Main Event Mafia was a pretty good angle. And then we get to Sting and AJ, which I would say is probably, other than Jarrett, AJ and Sting is probably the definitive feud of this time for Sting. And the build-up to this match was great. The build-up to that Bound for Glory in general in 2009 was excellent. It was honestly some of Vince Russo's best work. It feels like he knew he was on the way out because this is right before Bischoff and Hogan take over. And so it feels like Vince Russo is doing his best work so that, you know, maybe he can finesse his way into a job. listen, bro, you see what I did for Sting? yes. But Sting, I still remember, like, the build-up to Sting and AJ where it's almost like, you know, like you just said, Andy, AJ grants Sting this title match for helping him, but Sting keeps pushing AJ, and the story that they're telling is AJ respects Sting, but Sting is trying to bring the best out of AJ. He doesn't want AJ to take it easy on him because he's a legend and he's AJ's hero. And so, like, they just go back and forth, and then you end up with this really strong match at Bound for Glory 09 where AJ beats Sting, and, you know, they actually play it up where you think that this is going to be Sting's retirement match, and they have a really nice kind of post-match deal with Sting and AJ, and I thought that it did what it was supposed to do in that it elevated AJ to now take over as the star of TNA, at least in theory. That's what was supposed to happen until Bischoff and Hogan show up. But it sets AJ up as the top guy in the company, and it also gives Sting a nice note to kind of end his career on.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't end. He comes back in kind of a repeat of WCW, where he returns to the Impact Zone, appearing in the rafters. You know, he then shows up attacking Hogan and Abyss during a match against AJ Styles and Ric Flair, turning heel. As a result, he would later defeat by the debuting Rob Van Dam. During the following month, Sting would join other heel wrestlers against face wrestlers like Van Dam, Jared Hogan at Lockdown. Team Flair, formed by Sting, Desmond Wolfe, Robert Roode, and James Storm, were defeated by Team Hogan, Abyss, Jeff Jarrett, Rob Van Dam, Jeff Hardy. After defeating Jeff Jarrett at Sacrifice, Sting faced the World Heavyweight Champion, Rob Van Dam, at Slammiversary. However, during the match, Jarrett made his return and cost Sting the title. After assaulting Jarrett from behind, TNA president Dixie Carr suspended the storyline Sting for 30 days. When he returned, he changed his gimmick, wearing his NWO Wolfpack red face paint, and was paired with Kevin Nash. They would start a feud with Jarrett and Samoa Joe, facing them at No Surrender and Bound for Glory, where Sting, Nash, and D'Angelo De Niro defeated Jeff Jarrett and Samoa Joe. After Jarrett left the ring and Joe wrestled alone, at the end of the event, it was revealed that Sting had been right about Hogan and Bischoff all along, as they turned heel with Jarrett and Jeff Hardy as Abyss's yep. they, and in the process turned Sting, Nash, and De Niro back to being faces. On the following edition of Impact, Sting and Nash refused to join Hogan and Bischoff in their new group, Immortal. After a promo, they walked out on TNA, but Nash left the promotion for real, and Borden took an hiatus from TNA television as his contract had expired at the end of 2010. So what did you think of this heel run? And then it was like face heel, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. I love this run, Andy. Like, I think mm-hmm. it's so underrated in terms of the writing, because if you look at it on face value, yeah, like, Sting is aligning with the heels. Sting is acting in a heelish fashion, but he never turns. Sting is doing what he feels is right, because he knows he's done this before. He's done this dance with Hogan and Bischoff. Mm-hmm. And so, like, he's the only one who's out here on the island. It's like, hey, these guys are trash. Don't fall for it. You know, it's the one time in Sting's career where the character is shown to have some awareness about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, these guys are no good. Don't listen to them. Don't fall for them. And everybody else is like, oh, Sting, you're just being paranoid, man. These guys are good, Sting. And then it turns out that Sting wasn't the problem the whole time. Like, Sting was telling you the truth. And so I really liked how it was kind of like this version of Sting is learning from the mistakes that the Sting from the 90s didn't. Where he trusted Luger and he trusted the Horseman and he was betrayed by the NWO. Like, he's learned those lessons, and now we've got a more wise Sting, and he's trying to impart this lesson to these new guys in TNA, and nobody wants to listen to the old man in the corner.
No, but he returns on February 24th, 2011, at the tapings for the March 3rd edition of Impact, where he appeared as a surprise challenger and defeated Immortals World Champion Jeff Hardy to win the World Heavyweight Championship for the third time. At Victory Road, Sting successfully defends the title against Hardy in a no-DQ rematch that only lasted 90 seconds.
Of Jeff Hardy.
Yeah, it was cut short after Hardy was deemed too intoxicated to wrestle. Sting was later heard agreeing with a fan's claim that the match was bullshit. Following month at Lockdown, Sting successfully defended the title against Mr. Anderson and Rob Van Dam in a three-way.
Going back to that match real quick, that to me just shows the professionalism of Sting, because Jeff Hardy was in no shape to compete. For anybody that's watched that match, and I don't even want to call it a match, for anybody that's kind of watched that spectacle, Jeff is visibly either intoxicated or high or both when he comes to the ring and is in no shape to have the match. And Sting just goes in there and literally forces this guy. Like, because it's not like Jeff Jarrett, it's not like Jeff Hardy laid down for Sting. Like, Sting put this dude down and put all his weight and old man strength on this Jeff Hardy. And you could see Jeff trying to kick out. And Sting is like, nope, like, this is what's going to happen. And yeah, when he's walking away and the crowd is like, yeah, this is bullshit. And Sting's like, you're right, I agree. I think it just shows another level of, you know, just the professionalism of Sting, because I think to go in there and do what needed to be done and refrain, like, because I think if I was in Sting's position, I don't know if I would have been that nice to Jeff Hardy. Like, I might have gone in there and you know, escalated the situation to a place where it didn't need to be escalated. And that just shows you how Sting is this respected figure in the company.
Yeah, that's a great point. He defends the title again against Mr. Anderson and Rob Van Dam, and then at Slammiversary he loses the title from outside interference from Eric Bischoff. Now I remember this. I think this might have been when they got, I don't know, when did they get their Spike TV contract? What year was that? Do you remember?
They've been, I think by this point they've been on Spike for 4 years, maybe.
Okay. Because I remember this, when he kind of, he's displayed a more maniacal character, similar to the look and style of Heath Ledger's portrayal of the Joker.
Yeah, in
the
Dark Knight. He becomes Joker Sting.
Yes, I love this Sting, because he was just batshit crazy. On July 14th, he now dubbed the Insane Icon, regained the TNA World Heavyweight Championship from Mr. Anderson, after Fortune and Kurt Angle, disguised as his clown minions, attacked each member of Immortal, preventing them from interfering in the match. He would then go on to lose the title to Kurt Angle on August 7th at Hardcore Justice, after members of Immortal with a strange new personality. He would move it after Angle hit him with a chair brought to the ring by Hogan. Sting continued tormenting the members with, you know, his strange craziness. And his on August 18th of Impact Wrestling.
Yeah, I feel like one of my favorite segments is where, you know, because again, this is a natural kind of extension from the Sting that we were just talking about, where he tried to warn everybody about what would happen when Hogan and Bischoff came in. And so now he's taking matters into his own hands. And there's a segment where, like, because he's been putting clown makeup on other people when he's taken out Immortal. And so, like, he goes into Hulk Hogan's office and beats up Hulk Hogan. And you don't see it. You just hear the fight. And he's like, tell the truth, Terry. Take off the mask, Terry. And he just paints on Hulk Hogan's face, and he walks out, and then the camera turns around, and we just see Hulk Hogan, like, beaten up and his face painted by Sting. And it's like this, yeah, like, the Joker character is a bit divisive. Like, I know people that hate it and then people that love it. Like, I don't think there's anybody that's lukewarm on Joker Sting, but I'm with you, Andy. I think it's a fun performance from Sting.
Yeah, he's an older guy. He's having fun. He's getting the chance to just act crazy and really lean into the sports entertainment part of
And again,
of,
he's
of
like his, Wolfpack Sting turned up to 10.
Yeah, basically. You know, so then his longtime rival, Ric Flair, makes the return to TNA, challenging him to a match. Sting agreed to put his career on the line in exchange for Flair promising to deliver his long-awaited match with Hogan. Should he be able to defeat him? On September 1st edition of Impact Wrestling, Sting received a rematch against Angle for the World Heavyweight Championship, but was defeated following interference from Special Enforcer Hulk Hogan and the rest of Immortal. At No Surrender, Hogan once again cost Sting the TNA World Heavyweight Championship in a three-way match, which also included Mr. Anderson. On September 15th edition of Impact Wrestling, Sting defeated longtime rival Ric Flair to earn the right to face Hogan at Bound for Glory. After being exposed for his false claims of retiring and his secret ridicule of the fans, a furious Hogan impulsively agreed to hand TNA back over to Dixie Carter should Sting managed to defeat him at a pay-per-view on October 16th at Bound for Glory. Sting does defeat Hogan to bring Dixie Carter back to power. After the match, Hogan turned on Immortal and helped Sting overcome the odds in his battle with the Stable.
That was a surprisingly good match.
Really?
Like, for this era of Hulk Hogan, like, they pulled out all the bells and whistles, used all the smoke and mirrors, but, you know, the biggest indicator of a match's success, Andy, whether we think, you know, from bell to bell it was any good or not, is the crowd. And the crowd ate up everything that Hogan and Sting and Bischoff served them in this match, and they got a great reaction. You had, you know, Sting win, and then Hulk Hogan turned back into the old Hulk, and he got a genuinely warm reception by the crowd. And so, yeah, I thought at this point, I'm like, okay, things might be looking up for TNA. But little did I know, Andy, after what was on the horizon.
Yeah. All right. So during the first months of 2012, Sting feuded with world champion Bobby Roode. He was defeated by Roode Victory Road in an all-holds-barred match. And then during this time, he also left his general manager position in favor of Hulk Hogan. He signed a contract extension and was announced as the first inductee into the TNA Hall of Fame. His next feud was with the newly formed mass faction called Aces and Eights. What's your opinion of Aces and Eights? I know we're talking about Sting, but, you know, we're about to talk about the Aces and Eight faction for a minute. What'd you think of them on a whole?
I think Aces and Eights, in general, it was pretty bad. But I do think the one good thing that they gave us was heel Bully Ray.
Yes.
Which is a character that I'm surprised that Vince didn't utilize when the Dudley Boys made their return to the WWE, especially at a time where they needed, like, another kind of top-flight heel. So, yeah, Ace and Eights was kind of garbage. Again, it's one of these overbloated NWO ripoff factions, but heel Bully Ray was an excellent character.
Yes. So he fused with them, and where he fights with Bully Ray, where they defeated by Ace and Eights following the interference from a man who afterwards was unmasked as Ray's longtime partner, the returning Devon. As a result of their win, Aces and Eights earned full access to TNA. On the following episode, Sting defeated Devon via disqualification following interference from Aces and Eights. On November 8th, Sting was sidelined with a storyline injury after being put through a table and beaten with a ball peen hammer by Doc, a member of Aces and Eights. He returns on January 3rd of 2013, saving Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe from Aces and Eights before beating the group down with a baseball bat. He wrestled his return match the following week, defeating Aces and Eights member Mike Knox after he injured Kurt Angle. 3 days later, Genesis, Sting regained his revenge on Doc by defeating him in a singles match. And then he teamed up with Bully Ray to defeat Devon and Doc in a tables match. And at Lockdown, Team TNA, consisting of Sting, Eric Young, James Storm, Magnus, and Samoa Joe, defeated Aces and Eights, consisting of Devon, Doc, Garrett Bischoff, Mike Knox, and Mr. Anderson in a lethal lockdown match. After Bully Ray,
Garrett Bischoff and Mike Knox, like this is who we're bringing for this big battle.
Yes, and luckily they, you know, why didn't they put Wes Briscoe in there? Come on. After Bully Ray won the World Heavyweight Championship, revealed himself as the leader of Aces and Eights. Later that night, Hogan blamed Sting as he encouraged Hogan to give Ray the title shot, while also encouraging Hogan to support Ray's marriage to his daughter Brooke. Sting,
that's right. Brooke Hogan was involved in this nonsense as well.
Mark, Sting proceeded to walk out of Hogan. He then returned on April 25th, Impact Wrestling, saving Hogan from attack by Aces and Eights. The following week, Sting and Hogan reconciled, and Sting Hogan and became the number one contender for the World Heavyweight Championship later that night after defeating Matt Morgan. At Slammiversary 11, Sting unsuccessfully challenged Bully Ray for the World Heavyweight title in a no-holds-barred match after an interference by Aces and Eights. Per the stipulation, Sting would never get another world title opportunity again. On June 13th, Impact Wrestling, Sting noted that nobody in the back helped him during his title match. Would he form a new main event mafia to battle Aces and Eights? In the following weeks, he recruit Kurt Angle, Samoa Joe, Magnus, and Rampage Jackson as members of the new main event mafia. Before Bound for Glory, member Magnus complained to Sting because his losses. Magnus told Sting he had Flair put him on the map, but he had nobody, so Sting challenged him to a match at Bound for Glory. At Bound for Glory, Sting was defeated by Magnus, and then on October 31st, Dixie Carter offered to lift the Lifetime ban so Sting could get another world title opportunity by entering in a Battle Royal gauntlet match first, which was won by Magnus as Sting attempted to eliminate Kazarian and and Magnus eliminated both of them. Sting disbanded the Main Event Mafia after Aces and Eights disbanded, while other members began to chase the World Heavyweight title dreams. Sting started a feud with against Ethan Carter III and Dixie Carter after they began humiliating TNA legends like Curry Man and Earl Hebner. That's a sentence I never thought I'd ever say in my life. Legends like Curry Man and Earl Hebner.
Yes.
On December 12th episode of Impact, Carter was confronted by Sting and was issued an option. Either face Sting immediately or into the Feast or Fire match. Carter entered Feast or Fire to grab one of the briefcases. On December 19th, Impact Wrestling episode, Feast or Fire became revealed to create a future world tag title championship match. Also led to the firing of Chavo Guerrero. On the January 16th, 2014 episode of Impact Wrestling Genesis, Sting lost a match to Ethan Carter III due to interference from world champion Magnus and subsequently challenged Magnus to a title versus career match for the January 23rd episode of Impact Wrestling Genesis, in which Sting lost and his TNA contract was terminated as a result. So, what do you think of his TNA run on a whole, looking at it now, once now that we've talked it all out? Yeah. Was it fitting? Was it the right place for him to go post-WCW?
I think all things considered, it was. You know, obviously, we would have loved to have seen more prime Sting than the Sting that eventually ended up in the WWE. But, you know, I think for him, he made the right call, because who knows how he would have been treated up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was a chance for him to go with this young company and help them establish themselves, give them some star power, have matches with new talent, and, you know, put over this new talent. And I think he genuinely wanted to help. I think he genuinely wanted to be a mentor for these guys and girls. Did it work out as well as it could have? No. But that's not his fault. I think it's the fault of just TNA management being clueless at times.
Yeah.
But I think overall, like, he did the best he could in this run. There's a lot of just kind of filler, but then there's some really good matches in here. Like, I think his matches, Kurt, are really good. His initial matches with Jarrett are pretty good. And then that AJ match at Bound for Glory 09 is still probably one of my favorite matches to go back and watch. So, like, I think it wasn't the perfect run for Sting, particularly if this was going to be the end of his career. Like, it's not the perfect run, but I think it's as good as he could have hoped for, given the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I look back, it looked like he had fun. You know, because there's some stuff like, you know, when you're a guy who had done a lot in his career up to that point, you know, you get to form this Main Event Mafia with guys who are probably his friends, you know, and then get to be the crazy Joker Sting. Mm-hmm. I mean, and meanwhile, working with guys, you know, look at these guys. I mean, AJ Styles, Magnus, Samoa Joe. These are all-time wrestlers, you know, in terms of ability in the ring. And then, what happened, what we all hoped was going to happen, happened very late, but still it happened. You know, Sting was headed to WWE. Well, once, you know, we started working on things with the WWE Network, and they started doing home videos, and he started appearing in WWE video games. You knew he had signed a Legends deal, but, you know, which was
great. And that video, like, I think people forget how big that WWE 2K reveal was when Sting was coming to the game. Like, that was a big deal for the fans and for the company. Like, I think that, you know, anybody that thought that Sting had no value sorely underestimated his popularity.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, especially a guy in terms of merchandising alone, shirts, video games, action figures, you know.
Like, right now, WWE, if Vince was smart right now, they'd be putting out a Sting coronavirus mask. So, like, protect yourself and all the little Stingers out there with the new Sting coronavirus mask.
They should just go and get every mask wrestler or whatever, or face paint wrestler, and have corona masks. I'd be down for a Sting Joker corona mask.
Like, there's a market for it out there.
There is. The things we learn here in Evolution. So then he comes in on November 3rd during the main event of, now we're talking about 2014. On November 23rd during the main event of Survivor Series, Sting makes his first ever appearance in the WWE ring by attacking Triple H with the Scorpion Death Drop, which cost Team Authority the match. On January 19th, Sting makes his live Raw debut.
That was a hell of a debut. Mm-hmm. Like, I have issues with Sting's WWE run, Andy, but that was a hell of a debut. From the music, like Sting's new entrance.
Hearing the crow.
In the WWE with the crow. Like that entrance, and then coming out and helping Dolph Ziggler. Like, this is where I knew they were going to mess this up, because he gives Dolph Ziggler this huge win at Survivor Series. Like, even John Cena's been eliminated. So Dolph Ziggler wins against the Authority with the help of Sting. And that should be the beginning of the end for the Authority. But no, it's not. And so over the next few months, we get Dolph Ziggler being diminished. We get Sting not really being allowed to shine like he should, because it's all about Scott Crisola's boy, Triple H, and his lovely wife, who just take up all the screen time.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, too, is you talk about that music hitting. I think it's almost, it's first time played, it's over like the gong for The Undertaker. Mm-hmm. Like you hear, wah! The whole place knows what it is. It's Sting.
Yep.
Sting is here, what's happening? It's the same thing, like, all of a sudden when you would hear at it, and you weren't expecting it, the gong. Like, I was at Elimination Chamber right before this whole Corona thing with the great Cowboy Roger Morissette and Mr. J.R. Sonia D'Amato. And hearing that gong one last time, live, in an arena, it gave me chills. I'm like, literally, I'm getting goosebumps right now thinking about it. Because as a lifelong wrestling fan, you know, when you have that music, that pop that happens, that feeling, you know, not a lot of entrance songs could do that the first time you hear that. And yeah. Sting's WWE theme definitely did that. Then he makes his Raw debut on January 19th, 2015, by appearing backstage during the main event and then walking to the stage, causing a distraction, costing Authority members Big Show, Kane, and Seth Rollins in their handicap match against John Cena. This win gave the recently fired Dolph Ziggler, Ryback, and Eric Rowan their jobs back. He then Triple H then challenged Sting to a face-to-face confrontation. Sting accepted this challenge, and on February 16th episode, by sending a Sting doppelganger into the ring to scare Triple H, after airing a vignette, the big screen.
Yeah, and this is where I knew, Andy, that things were not going to go the way that I had planned it, because they let Sting, who was a good talker by this point, we've established, things gotten better as a promo over the years. They had somebody, it might have been Sting, but I don't believe it was Sting. I think somebody actually sped it up, and it sounded a lot like Eric Bischoff. But they had somebody voicing Sting's voice in the promo, and it's like, why would you try to hide your voice after you already debuted?
Yeah.
That player's showing up saying, I'm the Black Scorpion, and then the next week, Sting, you don't know who I am. It's like, yeah, I do. You just were out here last week.
So then, you know, Sting and Triple H had a confrontation at Fastlane on February 22nd. Sting points to the WrestleMania 31 sign with his baseball bat, issued a challenge for the event that was accepted by Triple H, and then Sting made a surprise appearance on the March 16th episode of Raw. It helped Randy Orton fight off the Authority. And then he ends up fighting Triple H at WrestleMania 31, which led to interference between DX and New World Order. Mm. So what did you think of this WrestleMania match?
I get what they were trying to do from the point of view of a spectacle, but it didn't make sense for the character of Sting, right? Like, Sting's big thing coming into this was, I'm tired of people. And again, I give them credit for making this Sting's motivation as a character, because it fits with everything from WCW to TNA to WWE. He's like, I'm tired of people taking advantage of wrestlers and asserting their authority over them. And so he's come to fight the authority because he doesn't want people to have to go through what he had to go through. But instead of making that the focus of the match, Vince McMahon or Triple H or whoever decides to make it WWF versus WCW one last time, mm-hmm. which is not the story that they were telling. And so when you bring in, like, I get DX coming in to help Triple H. That makes sense. But when you have the NWO, as we have established, Andy, the NWO have been one of Sting's most persistent foes through the course of his career. When you have the NWO come out to rescue Sting, and not the Wolfpack NWO, just regular black and white NWO, NWO Hollywood come out to save Sting, it just didn't make sense.
Maybe Luger and Conan weren't available.
And here's the thing. If you want to make it WCW versus WWE, you had enough WCW guys either in the locker room, or I think Booker T was one of the commentators.
Yeah, you could have had a team of like Booker T, DDP.
Yep.
You know, who knows?
Scott Steiner was probably still kicking around.
You know, William Regal was another guy that was known for WCW. And there were a bunch of guys that would have, and even if they weren't, they would have taken a paycheck to come into Northern California for the afternoon or evening.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and so I think that, like, as a spectacle, it worked just because it's like nobody was expecting that to be the match. Mm-hmm. But if you actually take a step back and think about it, none of it makes sense. And then we get, like, the insult to injury, Andy Atherton. Mm-hmm. Triple H goes over.
Yes. Which should not have happened. But they shook hands after the match.
And they shake hands. With the NWO holding Sting up and DX holding up Triple H, they shake hands. And it's like, that shouldn't happen. Because the story is, Sting is supposed to be here to help these young guys, like Dolph Ziggler. Dolph Ziggler should have been the one to come out and help Sting.
Yeah.
So they totally lost track of what the story was supposed to be.
Yeah, you
in order to get one more dig at WCW.
You even could have had NWO coming out for Triple H and get in fighting with a team of Ryback, Ziggler, and Rowan or something. Who knows?
Well, yeah, like you have the NWO come out, DX come out, and then Sting against the odds, like he's always been. But instead of him having to fight all these guys by himself, you have, like you said, Ryback, Ziggler, and then the big one, because they did have the tag match, you have John Cena come out. Mm-hmm. And Cena and Sting clearing house. Like, I think that's a cool way to kind of end this match, and then Sting gets the win on Triple H. And you kind of have WCW's all-time babyface with John Cena, who, whether fans liked it or not, like, is this era's version of a Sting or Ricky Steamboat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a... Yeah, why aren't you on the booking committee there?
I just want to be in the room where it happens, the writer's room where it happens, so Vince McMahon can yell at me and tell me my ideas aren't good.
Who do you think you are?
We got to get one more dig in at Turner, pal.
You're not the godfather. Charles Wright is the godfather.
I own your name.
All right, so Sting returned on April 24th, episode of Raw, and challenged the heavyweight champion at Night of Champions. Sting defeats the Big Show by DQ in his first match at Raw as a consequence of Rollins attacking Sting. That same night, a second match was booked with John Cena and Sting defeating Big Show and Rollins at Night of Champions. Sting was defeated by Rollins and suffered a legit neck injury after a turnbuckle powerbomb. So, I was never a fan of the buckle bomb. Or I'm not a fan of the apron bomb either. Because those just look like they're not... It's very hard to be safe on those moves, I think.
That's it. There's no way for the person taking the move to really protect themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame Seth Rollins for this, but Sting, at his age, should not have been taking this move to begin with. You know, he should have been more protected.
And Sting, like, up to that point in the match, Sting was actually looking really good. Mm-hmm. Like, he did a couple dives off the top rope. Like, I think if Sting doesn't hurt in this match, Andy...
Yeah.
There's a part of me that thinks they actually make the title switch.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying Sting would have had this long run.
No.
But I do think there was value in, you know, maybe a 1 or 2 month Sting run as champion.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he could have. He probably could have held it to Survivor Series or maybe the Rumble at the most.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, I think he probably was going to win. I think, and they had to call an audible because he was visibly hurt. I mean, I cringed when I saw that move. I just don't like it. I mean,
legs. You could tell his legs just leave him at that point.
Yeah,
and you have to give credit to Sting. Like he still tries, but there's nothing. Like there's nothing left in the tank.
Yeah, I mean, young guys have trouble with those moves. I mean, they're just when you're going with a force like that, whether those things have padding or not, it's still gonna knock you something. So then Sting said on the Ric Flair's podcast later that year that he needed surgery to correct cervical spinal stenosis and is lucky that a catastrophe didn't happen in his match. It was announced that on January 11th, 2016 on Raw, that Sting would be the first member of the Hall of Fame class of 2016. Sting ultimately reneged on having surgery on March 22nd, explaining that he felt completely normal and had none of the side effects associated with cervical spinal stenosis. During his induction speech on April 2nd, he announced his retirement from pro wrestling. He appeared at WrestleMania 32 along with his fellow inductees. So that pretty much, he has sporadic appearances. You never know, like he appeared on WWE television, on February 25th, 2019 on Raw, which was supposed to be a 70th birthday celebration of Ric Flair, but Flair was attacked by Batista before he could make it to the ring. And now, as reported, as of this recording, Sting is no longer under contract to WWE, although, you know, he could show up, he could make appearances. What do you think, you know, of course it's very underwhelming, but what do you think of Sting's WWE run, on a whole?
I think it was something that he had to do, and by he, I'm meaning Steve Borden. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there would have always been a what if he had not tried it, at least. And they actually, like, it started off so well, Andy.
Yeah.
Like, the stuff with the Survivor Series and you know, the like you said, they gave him awesome theme music. Like, they stayed true to the character, which I think was the first question a lot of people had, was would they try to make Sting a WWE creation. And they did a little bit with some of the stuff with Rollins, like stealing statues and all of that nonsense, but they kept a lot of stuff that made Sting cool. Like, I think at one point during the whole statue nonsense, there's a bit where Seth was supposed to unveil the statue, and he's been talking on Raw in the ring for like 15 minutes. And he's like, and now I want everybody to see my statue. And they pull down the curtain from the statue, and Sting's just there with a bat and just goes to town on Rollins. And so, like, they did a good job at the beginning, but they lost track of what they were doing. I think, you know, the WrestleMania match with Triple H was a big mistake in terms of the way that they booked it. I think Sting should have gotten that win. Like, it doesn't make sense to bring Sting in and have him lose that match after people have been waiting to see this guy for, you know, 20 years at this point. And it wouldn't have hurt Triple H to take that loss.
Yeah.
Not at all. So I think they kind of botched that. You know, the Rollins match, it was what it was. I think that, you know, if Sting doesn't get hurt, that's a great what if, because – then I think we do get a Sting title run, and we get more of these kind of late career dream matches where maybe we get Sting versus Cena, which could certainly headline a pay-per-view. And maybe we get that Sting Undertaker match that everybody clamoring for all those years. But I think there was a way, even after he got hurt, and I don't know how much Sting actually wanted to do with the WWE, but I think there was still a way they could have used Steve Borden. Mm-hmm. Their commentary has been so up and down the last few years. I think Sting could have been a nice, you know, maybe not the full-time commentator, but he certainly would have fit in better than trying to put Attitude Era Jerry Lawler in 2018 or 2020.
Yeah.
Oof. I think there was a place for Sting, you know, maybe because I think in TNA he worked really well as an authority figure, as the rare babyface authority figure. I think instead of, you know, Stephanie McMahon or Triple H always being an authority figure, or Shane McMahon. You could have brought Sting in and let Sting do that for a few months. Because Kurt Angle, I love Kurt Angle. Again, Kurt Angle might be one of the greatest professional wrestlers ever. Or he is one of the greatest professional wrestlers ever. But his run as general manager was so underwhelming.
Oh, yeah.
I think if you put Sting in that spot, it's a totally different vibe. Sting would, the character of Sting is not, you know, being bullied by Stephanie McMahon. At least I hope the character of Sting isn't.
Yeah.
You know, because Sting's got a little bit more bite than Kurt Angle. So I think that could have been cool. So overall, I would say, you know, it's not great. It's not terrible. It's kind of incomplete. You know, if I were to give his WWE run a grade.
Yeah. I mean, I have to go back and listen to the first episode of Evolution with Scott Criscoll, where we talked about Triple H, and here kind of compare the thoughts about that WrestleMania match. It's been a while since we recorded that episode. So
I think last time Scotty and I talked, because that is a hot button topic on the main event. Last time Scott and I talked about that, I think Scott's reasoning for Triple H going over was that they were preparing him for the Rock match with Ronda Rousey and Stephanie mm-hmm. versus Rock and Triple H, but we never got to that match.
Nah.
And so, like, I think even if Triple H loses against Sting, you can still heat him up for Rock and Rousey.
Yeah, that's true. So,
because Triple H is almost Teflon, like Triple H, yeah. can he can eat a loss because he's the boss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's like it's like Vince McMahon. You know, Vince McMahon wins, Vince McMahon yeah. loses. Doesn't really matter. So here's one of the final thoughts, though. So Steve Borden is no longer under contract. In an age now, though, where cinematic spectacles, if I don't know what the correct term is, where you have the Undertaker's Boneyard match, you have the Bray Wyatt's Funhouse match, like with Cena, or you have your Hardy compound, whatever you want to call it, or whatever they're going to do with Braun and Bray. Could we see Sting in one of these cinematic things? You know, could we get our Sting Undertaker match where it's shot and it's edited and these guys are protected and they basically kind of just go through the motions but don't take any real bumps or do anything that physical? Do you think we could see that before it's all said and done?
It's a possibility. I think that, like, again, everybody has talked about that Sting Undertaker match for years now, and it would have been really cool if they had done that. You know, Taker says he's retired, but, you know, you take that with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's a match that's always out there. I think, you know, Sting and Bray could be an interesting match. But let's say Sting is really done with WWE. I would love it if they brought Sting to AEW just to kind of close the circle. Like, this man kind of got his start back in the 80s wrestling for Turner. And to have him kind of come back full circle, like not be a full-time competitor, not even be a part-time competitor, you know, maybe do something cinematic like the Hardy compound or the match they had at the arena, the Jacksonville Jaguars stadium.
Yeah, football stadium, yeah.
That, like, because I thought that was really creative. And there's a way you can incorporate Sting into something like that, or even just have Sting show up as a legend, because we've seen how they used Arn Anderson, Jake the Snake, Taz, you know, some of these other legends, Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone. We've seen how they've been incorporated into AEW, and I think there's a way that you could bring Sting in where, you know, again, maybe things get so rowdy that AEW needs an authority figure. And he's not an authority figure that's out there every week, but maybe, you know, once a month or once every 2 months, we're setting up for something big, and Sting's got to come in and get control of things and lay some big announcement on us. You know, Sting becomes Linda McMahon, because when Linda McMahon used to show up in the 90s, you knew something big was going down.
Yeah.
When Linda McMahon shows up now, that's a different story, but we're not going to go there, Andy. But if you had a situation where, you know, Sting shows up to build something big for Double or Nothing, or to build something big for another one of AEW's big time pay-per-views, once we get back to actually having pay-per-views, in the normal way, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. I think Sting would be a great character. And he doesn't even have to, like we've seen, Sting doesn't have to have the paint to be an effective character anymore. He just show up as cool old man Sting with the jacket and mm-hmm. the shades.
Yeah.
And he can come out here, cut a promo and set up, you know, a big match for Cody or something like that. I think there's still value to Sting in the business. The question is, does he want to do it? Because obviously the dude's made enough money. He's happy now. He's gotten remarried and he's a devout Christian. And so it's like, if Sting doesn't want to do that, then, you know, I'm happy for him because he is, you know, the reason I'm here, Andy, is because he has been one of my favorite, if not my favorite wrestler of all time. And so, like, if that guy is done and wants to just kick back and relax, then he's earned it. So, you know, the fan in me wants to see Sting one more time. But if that match with Rollins was the last we get, then it's been a good ride.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a lot to go back and watch. A lot of greatness from Sting. Although, you know, him and AEW, I think him and Jericho would be gold. Like Le Champion, and then basically Sting would just come out and put him in his place. Oh my yep. God! From our lips to God's ears, Nate. But thank you, because I consider myself a big Sting fan. But you know, I got a lot of education tonight, a lot of passion, a lot of love, and that's really what this show is about. Where I get great guest from all of Place to Be Nation and somebody in here and talk about a great wrestler that had a long legendary career and just get a chance to really tell everybody why these guys are awesome. So I want to thank you.
I mean, there's a lot of great wrestlers, Andy, and I appreciate you having me on for this, man. It's been a long time coming, but you know, there's been a lot of great wrestlers over the years, but there's only one man, Andy Atherton. There's only one man who does this, and then he does that. There's only one man who's as big as a bull, but yet he's as quick as a cat, Andy. And that's the man called Sting. And that's why we need to celebrate him.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And speaking of celebrations, Nate, what recent shows do you have up or coming up that you can direct people to check out?
Oh, there's so many shows featuring myself, Andy. Of course, you know, right here on Place to Be Nation, you can check out the latest edition of Main Event that Scott Criscola, Steve Willie, and myself recorded. You can check that out. And then probably by the time you're listening to this, the newest episode of Main Event will be getting ready to drop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a bi-weekly show here on Place to Be Nation. You can check us out. This past episode, we talked about the question posed by one Scott Criscola. If 2020 is the worst year in professional wrestling history. So check out the episode and then find out what we thought about that. You can head over to Post Wrestling when you're done listening to the Main Event and check out a couple shows I got up over at Post Wrestling, the Rocky Maivia Picture Show. And also, we just released Braden Harrington from the NXT show, and I just released a special review of Hamilton. So two guys that have no clue what's going on with musical theater spend 2 hours talking about Hamilton, and you can check that out right now up at Post Wrestling. Of course, we got the Kings of Sport, Andy. We got the Patreon up, patreon.com/thekingsofsport. This episode was Marcus, myself, and PTBN alumnus TJ McClune. Mm-hmm. And we talk about Cam Newton signing with the Patriots. We also talked about the NBA and the bubble in Orlando. And we talked about Barstool Sports and some of the issues, let's just say, going on with Barstool Sports right now, Andy. And finally, Black Lightning Podcast over on the DC TV Podcast Network. You can check that out. We've been having a few shows this summer talking about not only what's going on with Black Lightning and the other CW shows, which are waiting to find out when they can go back to production, but we've been talking about this kind of representation in Hollywood and also race relations in America, because that's like the B-side to the summer mixtape of the coronavirus. Like you've yeah. got like the new hit, you know, COVID-19, that's the new hit that everybody's listening to, but America still got the B-side, which is the old of race in America that we're still playing. So we talk about that on the Black Lightning Podcast. And if you want to know about anything else I got, check me out on Twitter at N8MOZAIK at Nate Mosaic on Twitter. Because I don't know what's going on, you know. So just check, follow me on Twitter. You'll find out there. Because the only thing for sure about Nate Andy Atherton is nothing's for sure.
Yes, but one thing's for sure is we get lots of great content from you that you are involved with, and we're very appreciative of that. As for me, you can find me here on the Wrestling Feed. I am part of Body Press Your Luck. The newest episode will be coming out probably around the 24th of July with, let's see if Ryan can get taken down. He's the, I believe, the 8-time defending champion going into this episode. He is the only champion we've ever had. He is not the Kobayashi. He is the Joey Chestnut of Body Press Your Luck, I'm going to say. As well as there'll be a new episode of Great Debate Wrestling coming hopefully sometime, mid-July or early August over on the Pop Feed, which is my primary home. The next episode of Pop Goes the Classics, our Disney series. We look at all the Disney animated films in release order. We're up to Bambi. That is myself and Miranda Berthel. We actually are going to be joined by Steve Riddle for the first time. He'll be joining us. Chad is going on a brief hiatus, maybe back or not, but, you know, things are kind of busy at the NOSO connection. So we hopefully we love Chad, and we hope that he'll be on more episodes in the future, as well as my newest show, Blockbuster Rewind. The first episode was up. That was myself and my two co-hosts, Eric Eels and Scott Shiflett. We were joined by Tim Capel. We talked about Jaws and its sequels. It was a something that Tim Capel wanted to do for a long time. He was been dying to talk about Jaws the Revenge on a podcast, and we granted him that wish, and it was tremendous. On the next episode, we're going to be talking about some disaster films from 1998. That is Armageddon and Deep Impact, and we're going to be joined by the Queen of Place of the Nation, Jennifer Smith, as well as new episodes of Laugh and Theater coming soon. The next episode that will be up will be Back to the Future with Lee Elias of the Geeks Who Like Sports podcast. Lee is an old friend, and the 35th anniversary just passed of Back to the Future, so we're going to get that out just in time, and I look forward to that. That is going to be a lot of fun, and look for more episodes coming in the works. We have lots of other people that have not been in the Laughing Theater yet coming to debut, as well as some more group watches, so stay tuned for that on the PlayStation Pop Feed. Don't forget to check out the Jenny Position and North-South Connection podcast feeds as well as PlayStation.com. Every day we have all kinds of articles. And don't forget, go out and vote on Facebook. Like the page. It is the greatest song for a movie tournament. We've gotten off to a tremendous start. The vote numbers for each matchup are going up every day, and I really appreciate it. I really love it. There's lots of great conversations going on. And this is a wide-open tournament that you cannot predict. So I think it's going to be a blast. It's not going to be everybody loves, you know, Thriller. Not everybody loves Doritos, or everybody loves Friends or Simpsons or whatever results we've had in the past tournaments. So this is wide open. Everybody have fun. It's going to go on for a few months. And just, you know, it takes 2 seconds to vote every day. So go cast your votes. So I want to say a big thank you to Nate Milton, the Godfather, for joining me here on Evolution. Tremendous guest and a tremendous privilege and pleasure.
Appreciate you, brother.
All right. Thank you. For everybody out there, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode. Take care, everybody.